everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets. I am your host, Chris Zellner, along with my co-host, David Vixens fan. I'm talking about Exile and Bastion. We're dealing with my guest host, my co-host, David Vixens fan. Vix, how you doing?
I'm doing relatively okay.
Yeah, you had a little rough patch there earlier in the day, and you sound like you're doing a little bit better since we started talking on the phone, so that's good.
Yeah, I had to take a nap earlier. I was a little bit under the weather. Now I'm feeling a little bit better. Chris is making me feel better because we can talk about exciting things like another great Dr. Death Steve Williams Clash of the Champions promo, one of his many wonderful high-level money-drawing Clash of the Champions promos.
Well, one thing we won't be talking about on this show is Sunny Porn. So if you want to listen to that, we'll give you a plug later during the plug section where you can hear me talk about Sunny Porn.
Another podcast with Sheet in the name, though.
Yeah, another podcast with Sheet in the name. But we have our guest this evening on episode 29 of Between the Sheets, and that is Mr. Tim Livingston of the Pro Wrestling Super Show. Tim, how you doing?
Good, Chris. Bix, thanks for having me on.
That's right. Pro Wrestling Super Show on the Place to Be Nation Network.
Right.
The award-winning Place to Be Nation Network on the Sheeties Awards from Talking Sheet. So it's a lot of sheet sandwich love, talking sheet love here on this show.
That's right.
But anyway, we are discussing the week that was February the 2nd through the 8th of 1990. So we were in 1991 last week, 1990 this week. And we start the show off in the National Wrestling Alliance, where a lot of things are going on as the big Clash of the Champions is this week. But there's news that was out before the Clash that could have been a big deal in the NWA, as Dave Meltzer fully believed that Tully Blanchard would be debuting for the NWA on the Clash show in Corpus Christi, Texas on February the 6th. And if he's not there, then the chances of him returning would be extremely slim. Well, that's true. The talks first began on January 31st with Ric Flair finally convincing Jim Herd to allow him to bring in Blanchard for the Clash. The two sides were far apart on money to the point that it was figured no deal would be reached. Turner offered Tully around $156,000 a year, which Dave thought was more than fair for Tully at that time and slightly more than what he was making in WWF. But Tully demanded between $250,000 to $300,000, which is what he was originally promised when he was going to jump from WWF before the drug issues last November. However, by the end of the week, the two sides were back in negotiations, and while no contract had been signed, the two sides had come to an agreement on the $156,000 per year, with Blanchard working 176 dates. The contract was brought to the Clash, and he signed it before the show, before being involved in a horseman angle that night. Well, at the Clash, Tully got a contract, they had the correct money, but the dates had been extended to 300 dates, which is the same deal that Arn Anderson was under. Tully was upset, saying he had agreed to work 176 dates, and then was told that he had until showtime to make a decision. Tully basically decided to call their bluff, and he stayed in the locker room. If Blanchard was to have to come in, it would have been highly beneficial for the promotion, because the front office wanted Ole Anderson to be a non-wrestler only. And Bix, we talked about this story in the past when we've done late 89 on this show. And Tully, this was like every week, every other week in the Observer, there was always something about Tully either taking a job with Coca-Cola or, talking to NWA or whatever. And this is the culmination of all those talks.
Yeah, it wouldn't really be anything for another 3 years. By the way, I just think I just noticed, did you not put the thing from Matt Watch that I DM'd you earlier in the week in the notes?
I didn't read it. I guess we didn't get it in there.
Okay, because I do want to end this. WCW was hoping to have Tully Blanchard signed for the Clash Tuesday night. So if he was there, because this was, I guess it was, written before the Clash, but would have been in people's mailboxes after.
Yeah, I see it now.
Likely he was to be, instrumental in the attack on Sting. But the week before, Blanchard and his agent were ushered out of Jim Herd's office.
Yes. Yeah, I forgot to mention that. Yeah. So that shows you how negotiations were going at that point in time.
Yeah. And I think, and after this point, though, there's nothing until Slamboree 93 where he's there, and then who knows what happens with the whole Paul Roma thing. So, yeah, I mean, the whole thing is very weird. As we've talked about, apparently the initial Hurd welching on the deal when someone at WWF leaked the cocaine test positive, that was like this big deal within wrestling in terms of like screwing things up for WCW and especially Hurd with wrestlers. That they felt like WCW was going to welch on deals, so a lot of people just didn't want to go there.
Oh,
especially
yeah.
As long as Jim Hurd was in charge, which is something I don't think I knew until the Midnight Express scrapbook that Jim Cornette put out came out,
yeah,
that he mentioned there. And here, I mean, this is kind of the end of Tully as a mainstream guy. Pretty much. I mean, I guess he works South Atlantic a little bit after this.
Yeah.
And then he just kind of disappears, maybe occasionally working indies, and he has the ECW thing and Heroes of Wrestling, and that's basically his career.
Yeah. And, Tim, this would have been a big run for Tully because, you know, the Horsemen were going to be the lead heels, and Arn and whoever his partner was going into a feud with Steiners.
Yeah.
So who knows how things would have went.
Well, this was kind of the turning point that really, I mean, Jim Hurd and Ric Flair had always, you know, had the problems, and 89 was full of Flair really wanting to bring his guys in. He had Steamboat, of course, and then he had Funk. And then after that, you know, 1990 turns around and, you know, and then, you know, Sting was brought up as the guy who was going to be the next one. And Flair wanted to, you know, say, okay, well, if you're that's going to happen, then we should go about this way. And so Hurd, you know, I didn't really hear about the whole cocaine stuff that Bix mentioned earlier. I mean, I knew of the problems that Tully had, but the welching on deals and stuff like that I, in regards to that test, I hadn't really heard that part before. But I mean, if Tully comes in, you know, it really does kind of set things up. But you know, I, as we'll talk about later, it wasn't really Tully not coming in that kind of set the stage for what turned out to be probably the most chaotic thing that had gone on in the NWA at that time. It would have been big because, you know, Tully was still a big name. Corpus Christi, I mean, he's from San Antonio, so that would have been a huge return because of you know, his standing there. And you're right, him and Arn versus the Steiners, that would have been a great feud to have at that point. Instead, they had to go with Ole, who was Ole. And, you know, it turned out to be something that was just another thing that NWA couldn't kind of bounce back from. And it was a huge thing that backfired.
And Ole was decrepit.
Yeah, I mean, Ole was, you know, Ole could talk. We saw it in the promo, you know, later that night at the Clash. He was great in that promo. You know, it's kind of the stern, like, you know, fatherly, like, you know, old man on the block. Like, you don't come onto my lawn unless you want to face the consequences. But yeah, Ole as a wrestler in 1990 is just it still sends chills down my spine.
Well, that's why they didn't want him in the ring.
Right.
But
exactly.
The thing that doesn't get talked about enough with this whole deal is, all right, they turn the Horseman heel. Arn gets hurt.
Right.
At WrestleWar or right after WrestleWar, and Ole. So basically, Ric Flair is the only wrestling member of the Horseman for. Well over a month and a half before Arn's able to return to the ring, and they had to bring in Wayne the Train Bloom and Mike Enos under mask as Minnesota Wrecking Crew 2, but they're not really affiliated with Flair. They're Ole's guys. So you do this, you shoot this big angle, and there's no Horsemen. So if you do have Tully around, even if Arn gets hurt, you still have Tully there in a singles role where he can still do, you know, fairly big matches, maybe against like guys like Pillman or whoever you can throw in there, Tommy Rich or whoever. And you still have that continuity where, you know, once Arn gets hurt and is not able to be on television, it's just Flair and Woman and Ole and the Minnesota Wrecking Crew too.
Right.
So I mean, you totally killed the heat from that angle. For a while.
Think about all that. So in the span of 2 weeks, you have the Tully not show up. You have Sting get hurt, then you have Arn get hurt. It's kind of like what's happening now in WWE with all these injuries piling up one after the other, and you're going to plan Q. You know, it's like they basically had to scramble to get anything together. And this is why, for this particular thing, when this was brought up, Hurd doing what he did, because that was your general practice for you know, your NWA contracts at the time. I mean, to not have the foresight to say, like, okay, we're already a little bit thin. You need him to come in because he's one of the big names out there that can kind of come back and help you out right now. And you do this to Tully, you know, and obviously Tully was not in the best place. And so doing anything like this just makes that more volatile of a situation. It just seems like very short-sighted on Jim's part to do this to Tully. And good on Tully for calling his bluff. But if, like you said, like, this was the end of Tully Blanchard as a viable professional wrestler, basically. He wasn't anything after this.
Yeah. Now, Sting has been mentioned also at the Clash on February 6th in Corpus Christi. Sting suffered a serious knee injury that will keep him out of action for at least a few months. The injury was diagnosed as a torn patella tendon in the knee, with the patella being the tendon that holds the kneecap in place. Originally, he was to undergo an exploratory surgery on February 9th to see how much damage was done, but the decision was made later that he would undergo a more major operation on February 13th. Since the extent of the actual damage won't be known until they open up the knee, it's unknown just how long Sting will be out of action, although speculation is that he will be out of action for 2 months, provided the rest of the damage is minimal. That could change to 6 months, though, before he returns to the ring. The injury puts the NWA into a major panic, going into the Wrestle War, as Sting was going to defeat Ric Flair for the NWA World Heavyweight title on the show. This also adds to the inner turmoil within the promotion between the wrestlers, bookers, and management, which has grown to a point where management is basically pointing the finger at Flair for every problem, which Dave said he does deserve some of the blame, and they wanted the belt off of him in the worst way. A meeting was scheduled for February 12th to determine where the company was headed, since everything was being built around Sting, the babyface champion. And as of the end of the Clash, the top singles babyface was probably Norman the Lunatic. Flair versus Lex Luger will now be the main event, but the decision on Luger turning babyface hasn't been made yet and will be finalized at that meeting. But the feeling is that after the Clash, there's no way Luger wouldn't be the babyface in that match and subsequent rematches. Another wrestling rule of thumb is, when you have a major substitution on a major show, you have to find the way to have the babyface win the main event. Regardless, Luger's scheduled match with Dr. Death has been dumped, which makes sense since Dot's contract expired on February 11th anyway, and had already left for Japan on February the 8th, telling everyone he wasn't coming back to the NWA.
That's too good.
So, you know, Tim, the logic there that Dave has about the babyface should go over in that major substitution, it makes a lot of sense. And in this case, it would have been the right finish, but Flair has, you know, talked about this before. He was not going to job to Lex Luger. He told Sting that he was going to job to him for the title. He was going to pass the title to Sting. And this is one of the situations, though, and I totally agree with Jim Hurd, which is rare. Jim Hurd was right on the money here. Luger should have won the title, going off of the past history. What do you think?
I think you're right. I think, you know, one of the things I just talked about was how Jim with the contract and Tully Blanchard was a little bit short-sighted. But in this particular case, you know, everybody wants to side with Flair because Hurd was, quote unquote, not a great manager of the resources there. But in that particular case, right. No, isn't that something? I can't believe it. But at the same time, you know, his ability to see, okay, even if it's just a quick, you get, you know, and you have to say, let's assume the worst case scenario, which is Sting out until July, which, you know, eventually is what happened almost, is like, you get a few months with Luger and Flair. You get Luger finally getting that win over Flair, which eluded him back in 88 and is something that would be a great story to tell here in 90. And then you know, Flair, of course, wins the belt back. And then who comes back? Sting. What does that do? It sets up the, you know, the Great American Bash, where Sting eventually lifts the title. And I think you're right there. And Jim's right there for sure. It's like, why would you not try, and even though it's a short-term thing, just convince Flair? It's like, I understand you want to drop it to Sting, but it's like, you're going to get the chance to still do that, and Sting can still be the guy. And I think that is part of the part of, you know, everybody talking about the turmoil between the wrestlers and booking and management, is that I don't know if Jim was able to explain that well enough for Flair to believe him. And I think that, you know, Jim just threw his hands up in the air and said, all right, we'll just do it this way then.
Yeah, and
kind of weird.
Yeah, and Bix, the point about you know, the top babyface being Norman the Lunatic, well,
that's,
you know,
ridiculous.
Well, another guy that we didn't mention that also had left, and we'll talk about in a little bit, was Muda.
Right.
Who could have stepped into a role, but I mean,
well, there's the one we always talk about, Pillman.
Right.
Yeah, Pillman, but I don't know. And Pillman's a Flair guy. And of course, the Saturday night match is coming up, you know, in a week or two, you know, which, you know, is the match that everybody looks at as being Pillman's breakthrough match. But, you know, it's just a total chaos, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. I just don't I don't understand why they couldn't just go with Pillman, though. Like, I mean, yeah, it probably looks better in hindsight since they made the decision before TV and the Pillman thing was Pillman looks like a better choice after the match airs and all that. But I don't see why it's. But he was someone who could be slotted into that. You know what I mean? The Flair thing was based on being a storyline issue that Flair had been pushed as his mentor.
Yeah, it's an easy way to go.
Yeah, so why don't you use that for the pay-per-view? Pillman is Sting's friend. Flair is Pillman's mentor, blah, blah, blah. Like, he's not nearly as established, but you have a storyline there. And, I mean, there's also the option if you could do Luger, keep him as a heel. I mean, it wouldn't be the best scenario. But it's there. They squandered... I mean, look, they squandered a lot, and a lot of it was Flair feeling like he had to be a heel, though. I mean, that's a big part of it, too. I mean, that is where the blame should sit with him.
Yeah, he deserves the full blame on this. Another thing, too, is, you know, Luger was not Flair's guy. Luger was Hurd's guy, so that adds to the Flair-Hurd drama. So, I mean, it was just a total mess. It was a total mess. And one of the reasons why, you know, your top wrestler shouldn't be your booker in a lot of cases too.
You know, we can
go ahead.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
we can talk about Muda. As I said, we can talk about Muda later, but that is probably the most intriguing thing they could have done. And we'll talk about that later though. But it's just like that really could have been a very intriguing way to go.
All right, let's talk about the class proper now. We at the Corpus Christi Memorial Coliseum, drawing 3,000 fans, a $70,000 gate. And our first match features Dr. Dusty Williams pinning the Samoan Savage, reversed into a backslide. Notable things about this match, Woman took a seat at ringside before the match, and this was her only appearance of the show. Although they didn't mention a commentary that Nitron wasn't around anymore, so that's a good thing. They did a big deal with Doc being an actual doctor before the match, which is funny since he quit. And Jim Cornette made a mention during the match of a man with a towel stand outside the venue, noting many of the fans are dripping wet on the floor.
Oh, God.
A reference to the high Hispanic population.
Oh,
and Dave gave this match 2.5 stars. But Bix, we got to talk about Dr. Death's intro, where he was basically auditioning for a job on Trapper John MD.
Is that how you'd put it? I mean, his entrance started so Bad to the Bones playing, and they show him in his wrestling gear, but with like a paramedic's uniform's top, and he's carrying this guy who's playing dead, and he's trying to revive him, and he's giving him chest compressions. Hopefully he didn't break the guy's ribs. Knowing Doc, he probably did. And I remembered there being more dialogue to this, but than there is. But I do want to just play it for a second. His one line during this, and keep in mind this is from the network. So for some reason they've dubbed over Bad to the Bone with like really inspirational music. So it goes from seeming like this cute little Saturday night's main event comedy thing to something much different. So here we go.
No! Driver! To the hospital!
What?
then he's staring out the window wistfully as he's waving.
Oh, God.
I'm still not even sure what he said.
That music makes it so much better, too.
It makes this whole show so much better. I feel like we should have this playing on a loop throughout the rest of Between the Sheets.
Dr. Death, the Samoan Savage, one-on-one in just a few moments. Let's go down now to Gary Capetta.
No, yeah, let's go to
not,
me.
Yeah, let's not go to Gary Capetta.
Let's not go to Gary Capetta. Yeah, so
let's go.
So,
let's go. Well, at least you both speak Spanish.
Yeah. Well, Chris and I were joking about how this could easily be Dr. Death's like guest star appearance on St. Elsewhere or General Hospital or something like that.
Well, yeah, and they were trying to give him depth to his character. So,
and this whole show, by the way, has these experimental Saturday Night's Main Event type graphics.
Yeah, and which was noted in the newsletters as being, you know, a great thing. Like they were actually up in their production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they would do stuff like this throughout this year. 90 was an interesting year when it came to production of WCW, NWA. A lot of different stuff going on.
Yeah, and they had some other videos like this during the show. Nothing quite as out there.
No.
But I think there was like a Horseman video that they had that was kind of inset.
Yeah.
But I don't remember if there were any others, do you?
I haven't watched in a while, so I can't really remember.
But anyway.
Speaking of the Horseman, though, Terry Funk conducted an in-ring interview with the Four Horsemen, Ric Flair, Sting, Arn Anderson, Ole Anderson, in which Ole said the reason Flair brought he and Arn in was to get rid of Sting. And the only thing that spared him was saving Flair against Funk. Ole said Sting did the one unforgivable thing by signing to face Flair for the title at WrestleWar. Ole said Sting would be spared again, only if he canceled the title match, and he had until the end of the show to make the decision. Moments later, Ole and Arn held Sting by the arms as Flair verbally berated and slapped him. Dave thought this angle reeked of desperation, even if it was a classic angle. And Tim, the thing about this angle was the weird, like, rewriting of time that was going on here.
Yes.
Because, you know, the bit about, you know, Flair bringing in Ole and Arn to get rid of Sting, well, that was false, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a lot of stuff that you could tell that all this was written on the fly because of the Plantoli deal falling through, but it was still executed really well.
Well, by the way, when you say that, are you assuming that Tully was going to sneak attack him?
Who knows? Who knows what the original plan was, but it would have been better, I would think, than what we got.
Promo, though, especially from Flair.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and Ole Anderson, of course. This is his element. So.
Right.
But, Tim, what are your thoughts about this angle?
Yeah, I mean, Ole was interesting. He was kind of the star here, which was odd. Well, I guess you shouldn't say odd because Ole would always love to try and make himself the center of attention when he could. So, but he did a really good job of putting over the ideas, even if there are some facts that were a little bit out of line, like you mentioned. But it was an effective angle, and it was kind of a desperate – I see where Dave's coming from here in the sense that he thinks it reeked of desperation because well, so much was happening at the time with the Tully thing that they kind of felt that they had to go all in with this idea of turning Sting, and you know, they had to really make it seem like a big deal because what they thought was going to be the big thing about this angle wasn't going to happen anymore since Tully decided not to sign. So, you know, I feel like there was really good work done here. I love Sting's bolo tie in this. I think it was a great added benefit to this promo because it made him stick out. I love how also Ole totally dressed for the occasion. Nicely done, Ole. But it was kind of weird. I think if you're into the politics at the time, like Dave was, you can see the quote unquote desperation. But you know, 5-year-old me watching this loved it. I thought, you know, I wanted Sting to kick everybody's ass after this. So. But it was a great angle. It really was. It was kind of for the time, for the circumstances. It was definitely a very good angle.
Well, basically, got the Horseman instantly over his heels too.
Right.
So that was the plus.
When they had been getting more and more over his babyface.
Yes, and they were great babyfaces, especially Ric Flair.
Right.
That one match from Johnson City, from what was it, Power Hour?
Yeah.
where what I think it's Sting, Ole, and Arn against Buzz, Dragon Master, and Muta.
Yeah. Later in this show.
I mean,
before.
The one on Power Hour, like a week.
Oh, before. That one's a great match too, right? Yeah.
Yeah, the one that set up what we have here going on this show. Yeah.
And it's probably one of the matches or tapings that led to the idea of Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Because it was during this time that Cornette was noticing, hey, these shows in Knoxville and Johnson City have a lot more fans, a lot more hot crowds, etc.
Yeah.
And as far as the promo, I feel like this is actually maybe one of the most quotable, in the angle/pro. I think Flair's promo screaming at Sting is possibly the most quotable individual Flair promo.
Yeah, it's up there high on the list.
Right.
Should I play us a little bit at the climactic moment?
Sure.
Okay.
Sting, I bought you a little time because of what you've done.
Yeah, you're too easy. The whole deal is this. You got 2 hours to make up your mind, and you're no longer a horseman. And if we ever see you again, you're not going to be quite so lucky as you are tonight.
God damn you, Sting.
And then he grabs Ole. Flair's punch, I love in this.
Yeah.
Come on.
Here we go.
Look at this.
I love hearing the slaps. I tried to tell you. I bought you some time.
Not do the smart thing. Smart up. Get out of this business. Get rid of that contract. Get out of my life. You're good.
I cannot believe this. But
this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Corny. Oh,
this is pathetic.
Ric Flair.
Absolutely pathetic.
He gave the guy a chance.
Yeah, you're a big chance. Fans, we'll be right back. This continues live. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Boy, they're not letting anything register here, are they?
No, they aren't. No.
Very TNA-esque.
Well, they were on time cue, so yeah. But a definite classic angle, no doubt.
One thing I'm noticing there, I know I have headphones on, but the audio production of the WCW and late era Crockett shows was so many leagues ahead of WWF at the time.
Right? Yes.
You can hear Flair's not like theatrically slapping him. You could tell to try to make it loud, but you can still hear it.
Yes, they definitely had a different system of miking that, you know, WWF had at the time.
And there's probably a very obvious reason for that when you think about it.
Yes, regarding the work in the ring. Let's move on to the show. We have Brian Pillman and Tom Zink beating the Mod Squad in 1957, one-star match there. Mil Máscaras pinned Cactus Jack Manson in 5 minutes. He was suplexed into a ring across body off the top after knocking Cactus off the apron onto the concrete floor. At the commercial break, Cactus was still in the ring as the Tough Guys performed near the entrance stage. The Tough Guys was a rock and roll band who was just there. Moments later, Cactus confronted the band's drummer, Wolf Wild, or as we know him as JT Southern, that's right, the wrestler, with the drummer then taking his shirt off and brawling with Cactus in the aisle. They thought this was a unique idea for an angle because it looked realistic, but what was the point of it? Southern is out of his league in the NWA, and they already have too many faces with rock and roll gimmicks, so if he isn't coming in, what is the purpose other than make Cactus Jack look worse? Apparently the security pulled Cactus off too fast because he was supposed to get the advantage. Two-star match. But Bix, yeah, Wolf Wild, JT Southern, and, you know, I watched this, you know, when I watched this show recently, and this was just a strange angle.
Well, the whole thing is strange because you've got the Tough Guys. I guess the Tough Guys are allegedly supposed to be the band behind the World Championship Wrestling theme song.
Yeah.
And so they play it, but there are lyrics. Which I believe were something along the lines of championship wrestling, wrestling champions.
That took a lot of time to write that song.
Yeah. And then, right, JT Southern not acknowledged as a wrestler. Apparently he's a multi-instrumentalist in real life, though, so that's good to know.
Yeah.
Also, we know of his guitar playing skills from the famous angle with Van Hammer, where he's the heel for calling out that Van Hammer can't play guitar.
Better musician and wrestler, no doubt.
Yeah, former, what was he, Southern Tag Team Champion, though?
With Alan West, yes.
And, wait, didn't he also, wasn't he also international champion? Didn't he also hold one of the Memphis titles with Snuka when Snuka was in Memphis?
Yeah, him and Jimmy Snuka. Yeah, him and Jimmy Snuka were international tag team champions.
Wasn't it literally for like a week and then Snuka was gone?
Yes. Wait, well, what a shock. Brother, I can't kill anybody in Memphis, brother.
Hey, Jimmy, what are your memories of Memphis?
Those are some real good memories, brother.
Good memories.
By the way, the network cuts out the tough guys' performance because
yes, they do.
I guess they don't have any rights to the World Championship Wrestling theme.
They spared us that moment. No.
The song is a good theme song. It's
okay.
The lyrics are bad. You don't like the 89-90 era?
Yeah, I like it.
Okay,
I like it. I don't like their version of it.
Now, remind me at this time. So, of course, this match is famous for Jack doing the Nestie Plunge and Corny.
Oh, yes. In his book.
And I was going to bring this up. So, isn't it kind of assumed, and I can't remember this because I haven't read that book in quite some time, but isn't it assumed that Jack was out of it to the point where he wasn't really sure what was going on in the post-match? And that was kind of why, you know, I'm not sure if that's the truth or not, but I thought there was something to him taking that plunge and him not really knowing what he was doing, or maybe that was a rumor I heard someone else say, but that could definitely be implied by what happened after the match.
I have to
look that up now.
Yeah, I haven't read Have a Nice Day in so long.
Yeah, it's been forever since I've read that book.
My memory is that he was not as screwed up taking the bump that time as he was the other times he took it.
Okay, all right. Because I could definitely get those all mixed up because he only took it a few times, but he talked about when he got messed up off the bump, and I can't remember if it was on that one or not.
And Mil Máscara is here. Quite the odd, you know. I guess it was in Texas.
You know what idea it was?
Jim Hurd.
No, Jim Barnett.
Oh, Jim Barnett, that's right. I had my gym. I knew it was a gym. We have to get Mil Máscara in this market because, you know, he's Mexican. You know, they draw in Texas.
Oh, God. And who are we going to put him up against? Who can he go with?
My boy.
I'm going to put that up against Cactus Jack Manson. Really?
Well, you know who he worked on television to build up this match?
I
forgot.
Forgot too.
The Galaxian. Danny Davis. Nightmare Danny Davis.
I was going to say, I hope it's Danny Davis and not the other one, because that would be a terrible week. This would be a terrible week.
Nice. Yeah. All right, moving on. Norman, the number one babyface, pinned Kevin Sullivan in a Falls Count Anywhere match at 6:15. And here's a video that we forgot about, Bex. Prior to the bout, a vignette of Norman visiting Zoo Atlanta was shown, in which he met a pot-bellied pig and named it Kevin Sullivan. Yeah, that's the video we forgot. It was him at the zoo. The pinfall occurred off-camera in the women's bathroom, where they had one of the secretaries in there shrieking to make you know it was a real woman's bathroom. Half a star with the sight gag elevating it into positive territory, according to Dave. And Gordon, one of the hottest of this, Tim, was Gordon Soley was like standing outside the bathroom trying to get play-by-play.
Oh, Jesus Christ, yes. Oh, my God.
Highlight of his career. I'm pretty sure he drank a whole bottle of vodka.
I'm about to say, yeah. I bet when he was told this before the match, what he was going to be doing, he definitely had himself a few drinks before he decided to get on the mic there. So I want to see Kevin Owens do this type of angle going to the zoo before a match with, like, Sammy or Dean Ambrose. Noted zoo enthusiast Kevin Owens. and see if they can redo this ankle with Norman the freaking lunatic. Oh God! Also, I think this is the first time that NWA WCW pulls out the women's bathroom trope.
Yes,
this is the first time they did a Falls Count Anywhere match.
And this is the first time that would become the first of many times where that would happen.
And Kevin Sullivan was involved in most of them.
All of them.
Gee, you wonder who booked that segment.
Yeah, right.
Each time.
And then Norman comes out of the, and then after the fall, well, the finish, I guess I'll just explain the whole finish.
Oh,
it's
God.
They go into the ladies' restroom. A woman runs out screaming. Nick Patrick follows them in, as he is known to do.
Allegedly.
Oh, God.
And we hear things, you know, we hear fighting. I guess we hear Nick Patrick counting a fall. The door opens. Kevin Sullivan staggers out, but then falls on his face. Then Norman walks out with a toilet seat around his neck, and Nick Patrick declares him the winner.
And, Bix, we got to talk about Norman. I mean, we joke about Norman being a top babyface, but he really was over at this time period.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he really, really was.
And then, was it Ole that made him a trucker?
Ole hated him. Hated
well,
his
I know
guts.
Ole hated him, but was Trucker Norman Ole?
Trucker Norman, yeah. Yeah, Ole hated his guts. And you could definitely tell the turn, yeah. You know, when Ole took over of how Norman was treated. But.
He was still a very good worker at this point, too. He just wasn't necessarily getting
good promo.
To show it, too. Yeah. And he was a kid's attraction, which Hurd was badly, dearly, you know, searching for.
Yeah.
And was starting to get over with the whole teddy bear thing.
Yeah.
And they...
Yeah.
And then Ole just ruins it. I mean, he's not a main event babyface, but he's someone they could have done something with.
Oh, totally. Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, look, a year and a half later when Global starts, what's the first angle they run? It's that Norman, all the kids have brought the teddy bears for Norman, and then he turns heel and becomes Muckin' Singh.
Yeah, which he was great in that role, but, you know.
But I'd say Norman had a lasting impression on people.
Yeah. Now let's go to my favorite part of the show. Terry Funk did conduct an in-ring interview with United States heavyweight champion Lex Luger regarding the previous incident between Sting and the Horseman, in which he said he was a top contender. Sting should have never been offered a title shot in the first place, and Luger would take Flair's title. Dave said that this was the worst interview Luger had ever done since turning heel, as he was out there forever with nothing to say. Dave mentioned Luger talking about all the, quote, allocades, unquote, in his career, with Funk trying to wrap him up, making you look amateurish. Dave says it's one thing for wrestlers to turn back and forth, but Funk turning back and forth is a bit much. Because his Funk was, you know, be babyface at times and heel times in his commentator character. And Steve Beverly reported that Luger was extremely upset backstage, feeling that Funk cut him off too early. His allocades, Bix.
I used to think about making jokes on Twitter about that being Rusev's finisher, but I didn't think anyone would get it.
Oh yes. Man, you would have popped Chris though. Chris would have loved that.
Yeah. Do we want to revisit this interview?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. I might have to put my headset on mute for a couple minutes, but
yes, please.
Why?
No, this interview is so bad it's great. No, okay, I gotta hear it again.
If Sting gives it up tonight, then Luger could slip right in there. Phrasing.
Yeah. Now notice that Luger's music is used here, unlike other times when it's not.
Imagine Cornette saying "slip in the back door."
Come into the ring and help me. In fact, what would you have done if you were me in that same incident, Mr. Luger? You know, Terry Funk, I've watched you for a long time. You're a man's man. I'm a man's man. Sting is a phenomenal athlete. He will accomplish many things in this sport. One day, he may even be world's heavyweight champion. What he's got to understand. Now, hold on.
Understand?
What he's got to do.
He's got to understand, Terry, his place in this sport at this time.
Also, Luger's
and
shirt.
And what is that? He should be happy where you're at, Sting. Take my advice, because, Terry, I am the number one contender. That match should have never been signed in the first place. Yes, you are.
Also, Ric Flair and I are no friends. Make no bones about that. But we have gone tooth and nail almost every night of the week across this country. You develop a mutual respect.
He's really not saying anything at all.
He has taken a physical beating and a kind of punishment from me as of late that he has never endured. I'm on the verge of winning the world's heavyweight title. Flair is hanging on by the very edge.
He's doing a lot of hand acting in this, too.
Yes.
A lot of fists and pointing and touching Terry.
Putting his nose anywhere it doesn't belong and walking off with a world title against a weary warrior such as Ric Flair. Now, Terry, I heard your introduction. And it was apropos for a man such as myself.
You can see that Terry's getting the go-home signal in his
thing
at this point.
You've got the total package. The total package.
And there we go.
Now I listen to your introduction.
Allocates.
Lex Luger is endless. I am and I have what every woman wants. I am what every man wishes he could be. I am what every youngster out there aspires to be in the future. Everything I touch turns to gold. I am the epitome of success.
But Lex Luger, I am a commentator, Lex. I am a commentator, and I know you have a lot more to say. And I know
you're the secretary. I'm on a roll, baby.
I'm on a roll, baby.
One thing that I have not achieved in my career, and I will achieve it. One thing I don't think. Everything I have wanted to attain has been mine. The world title, mark my words, will be mine. But for now, I am scheduled to defend my title as a U.S. heavyweight champion, the greatest, may I add, U.S. heavyweight champion.
U.S.
Yes, I know you're on a roll, but we'll be back with the skyscrapers and the road wires, Mr. Walker, right after this important message. And don't you people forget it.
God damn it. What a segment that was.
Those guys spoke for 5 minutes and didn't say a single word. It was the freaking greatest.
And the only way that Terry could get him to stop was to stare directly into the camera.
Yeah.
Close the segment.
Oh, man, because we had to get to this match. The Road Warriors defeated the Skyscrapers by DQ at 7:15 when Spivey repeatedly hit both Hawk and Animal with a steel chair and hit a clothesline on Ellering. It was announced the teams would compete in the Street Fight at Wrestle War 90. Dave gave this match 2 3/4 stars. Yeah, and Mark Callis, of course, would become The Undertaker. So there you go. All right. Your NWA World Tag Title deal here. We have the Steiner Brothers defeating Doom in 13:13 when Rick pinned Butch Reed with a roll-up, knocking Doom number 2 off the apron. Why, you ask, Butch Reed's name and Doom number 2's not named yet? Because Butch Reed's mask was taken off as Rick amassed and put the mask on himself. And due to pre-match stipulations, the challengers were forced to unmask. And after the bout, Gary Michael Capetta announced if Doom number 2 refused to unmask, he would be suspended. Moments later, Doom number 2 unmasked, revealing himself as Ron Simmons. Dave gave this match 3 stars. And Tim, you know, Ron Simmons just did the Legends with JBL this last Monday, where this was talked about. And mentioned, and like everybody else knew, you know, it was no secret. You had to be a complete moron to not know that it was Butch Reed and Ron Simmons under that match. Because like you said, man, that wasn't, there was like 5 black guys there, and look at us, you know, like you could tell who we were.
Well, but, and 2 black guys disappeared right before Doom debuted.
Well, exactly. But Tim, I mean, I like Mass Doom for the absurdity, but of course, once they unmasked, they became one of the best tag teams of that era.
Yeah, and 1990 was a great year for this team because, you know, they and we talked about it earlier where it was supposed to be Arn and Tully feuding with the Steiners. It would be Doom who actually, you know, takes the titles from the Steiners and they roll with it in the 90s. And they have a great year until, you know, they see dollar signs with Simmons and they break him up with Butch a little while down the road. But, yeah, I mean, Doom was great at this time. It's totally underrated. And, They might be, you know, we're doing the top 25 tag teams for the Greatest Wrestler Ever project over at the PWO boards, and they have a chance to sneak on my list. They are very good. They were not together for a long time, but I think it was really cool to, you know, even though they lose the masks, you know, at that point you think, well, you know, like you're talking about, it's like it was almost like a, you know, you had to do it because everybody knew who they were anyway. But it also allowed them to be a little bit more vocal and a little bit more themselves. And they got over as great heels in 1990. So it was definitely, you know, it was a necessary thing, but it helped both guys really get over.
And they had dropped Woman and would take on Teddy Long not that long after that. But Bix, you know, that begs the question, if the Tully thing goes through and Arn and Tully become the main tag team, where does that leave Doom in 1990? What do you think?
Probably feuding with – I mean, they eventually feud with the Road Warriors, but it's like, what, you think they're skyscraper bound? Or
and that
like,
was
like,
really just a TV program too.
Right. They didn't they didn't really draw with them.
I'm trying to remember, when was that? Was that late 89 or early 90?
Early 90.
That was like the Road Warriors' last program, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
I remember the what was it? It was supposed to be Steiners and Road Warriors against Doom and who was it on Power Hour?
Steiners and Warriors against Doom, and I think it may have been Minnesota Wrecking Crew too.
And then one of the baby faces no shows for some reason.
Yeah, that's when they started doing. They did singles matches.
I forget
with all
exactly
the tag
what
guys.
The match was. Yeah, and the,
yeah, they ended up doing singles matches with all the tag guys.
Yeah, I'm
much.
Trying to figure out where Doom fits in, especially because now Woman's out of the picture. I mean, I guess, do you keep them around? Do they still end up with Teddy Long?
They probably feud with Rock and Roll Express more than what they did do. I mean,
probably.
Hillman and Zinc, maybe. They're probably U.S. tag champions.
Right, instead of world champions.
Yeah, that's probably where they end up being. Then
well,
that
and Zinc
that,
would have been a really good feud for them.
Oh, I think so. I was always surprised they never got a world tag title shot. Was
well, so,
game
well, so soon after this, you know, the Rock and Rolls and the Midnights have their final, you know, their big final last match. Maybe, you know, maybe they slide into the Midnights role or like an alternate Midnights role in the 90s.
And the Southern Boys would come in too. I mean, that's right. a ready-made angle there. The Black guys get Southern Boys.
Right.
Stuff with that.
But knowing WCW, they would have kept Woman with Doom if they were going to do that.
So, I mean, there's a lot that went into play there with you know, regarding Tully not showing up with not coming out with how Doom, you know, how they would be portrayed. So,
well, also, I'm trying to remember what entrance music did Doom have on this show?
They didn't have the jazzy stuff yet, I don't think. They didn't have the awesome.
They didn't have the Bob Seger either. Oh, did they maybe just have no entrance or no?
And they had no entrance, if I remember right. Yeah, and her strut, of course, was gone by then. So,
right.
But soon we would have.
Yeah! One of the great themes for the air.
Hell yeah!
I'm also, on YouTube, I pulled it up with a custom Titantron, which is actually really good.
Oh, the people who do those custom Titantron, there are some that do excellent work. Definitely. Yeah, what a great
I was going to say. And I think it wasn't in the contract per se, but when they eventually broke up, the winner of that cage match, I think, got the music. And I think that's
why. Which, because Teddy didn't need it no more. He was with Johnny B. Badd. Anyway, moving on to the main event, we have Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, and Ole Anderson, subbing for Sting. So that's where Tully Blanchard would have come in. He would have worked in this match. Defeated the Great Muta, Buzz Sawyer, and the Dragon Master, of course, Kendo Nagasaki. In a steel cage match in 6-12, Arn pin Dragon Master with a DDT. Prior to the bout, pre-take comments from Flair and each of Muta's team were shown because of the Horsemen's attack on Sting earlier in the show. When in fact, the Horsemen were babyfaces in this as well, so total WCW. Muta, Sawyer, and Dragon Master were cheered as babyfaces for the match. There were numerous chances we won't Sting during the contest. Sting appeared at the 3-minute mark, attempted to scale a cage to get a Flair, but was held back. Taken backstage, returned months later, where Flair climbing the cage as well to meet him, but was held back by security. Brian Pillman, Tom Zink, Scott Steiner, guys like Wahoo McDaniel, you know, Doug Dillinger, while scaling the cage, Sting suffers a serious knee injury, of course we talked about, had to have help to stand, Immediately after that, Flair left the cage and attacked Sting in the aisle, with other wrestlers' security eventually breaking up the fight that closed the broadcast. 2 stars. And if you listen to the Flair podcast with Sting, they talk about this, and Flair did not know that Sting was hurt. And Sting was trying to, you know, get the message to him, but Flair never heard it. So that's when Flair jumped on him, you know, and found out later, sir, Flair was legitimately upset. I mean, he could, you know, he was, it messed him up. But Bix, I mean, this, oh man, what, I mean, this was a huge blow to that company, because Sting had the upward momentum. They just did the big angle, and now he's hurt and out of action until, you know, the Great American Bash. I mean, how WCW of everything to happen here, huh?
Yeah, I mean, the whole segment's kind of a cluster, too.
Oh, the match was just total garbage.
And they have this cage. It's like, it's a WWF-style cage, but it's also really short.
And Buzz Sawyer, didn't he do a dive off the top of it?
Which is, I mean, it's still a few feet higher, but it didn't look as majestic as they wanted it to.
Yeah, but Biggs, like I said, this was WCW.
Right, and then, you know, Wahoo injures Sting's knee.
Yeah, Wahoo's basically the one you can blame for this.
Yeah.
Because he yanked
him off.
Yeah, that's not a good idea. Yank him, actually legit yank him off as he's climbing the cage. And it's pro wrestling. Aren't you supposed to just pretend to be pulling, to try to pull him off?
Well, this is Wahoo, though.
Yeah.
Wahoo's world of pro wrestling is different than other people's world of pro wrestling.
That is true. That is true.
Oh, God.
I mean, this whole thing, though, and then they don't know what to do, and they overexpose Sting while he's hurt.
Oh, totally. I mean, he was on TV every week.
Yeah.
Every week.
And then, of course, I don't remember if I tried to enter. I think I begged my parents to write down the address so I could enter the Sting coloring contest.
Yeah.
But I don't was there an actual sheet they had to send you in the mail, since it was a coloring contest and not a drawing contest?
I would think so. I mean, I didn't do it, but I would think they would have to be something that you would have to get to use. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did not ever enter, but I really wanted to. I wanted to win the 10-speed bike. Remember that was a big deal when in that era, it was like you didn't just want a bike; you wanted a 10-speed bike. No one had any clue what it meant.
Yeah, of course. But it sounded great.
It sounded cool. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, Tim. I mean, and we talked about this angle a lot already, but it was a bad situation.
Yeah, and the match was rushed because they were going long, too. That's another thing with this match. It's only 8 minutes.
Thanks, Lex.
That kid, Lex. Muda's pop in this match when he enters the ring for the first time is, like, ridiculous. Like one of the loudest pops anybody got all night, if anybody got all night besides Sting.
The fans react like they did a double turn.
Yeah, like this was kind of like they thought that this – and this is what I was going to talk about earlier. Maybe we should hold out for maybe Chris, why don't you bring up the next point that's going to be talked – that's actually related to this match, because that's going to get into my point that I was talking about earlier with Muda.
Well, exactly. After the clash was over, we had the great Muda quit the promotion and no-showed all the dates he was booked for. But the NWA was trying to get him to come back, with him agreeing to meet with him on February 12th. With the plan being for him to be turned babyface, along with a possible ruse shoe deal, as well as the rumored comic book deal from a few months ago. Muda supposedly told one NWA exec that, quote, "Why should I stay if they have no plans for me?" unquote.
Right.
And, you know, the don't do a Muda's babyface. We've talked about this on the show. Gary Hart was against it.
Hold on, let me pull it up.
Yeah, Gary Hart supposedly was the one that didn't want that to happen. But Tim, you, I mean, like you were saying, the fans had Muda was a babyface to the fans when he debuted.
Right. I mean, he was the most unique guy to step in foot in the United States wrestling ring maybe ever. Like, he was even better than Kabuki, and Kabuki was, you know, your general generic Japanese painted mask, you know, heel. Muda should have been the guy. As soon as Sting went, like, as soon as he found out Sting got hurt, Jim Herd should have gone to Muda and said, we want you. Not Luger. He should have said Muda. And this match is why I think that, is because when he entered that ring, there was little doubt who the fans wanted most in this match, and it was Muda. And he could, it would have been a great story. You could have gone right into the babyface stuff that was talked about, how you need the babyface to somehow win that match. Can you imagine that? Muda with the moonsault, which was probably the most protected finisher in the NWA at the time, hitting it on Flair and winning the belt like that. And, you know, you get to trade with Flair back so that Flair can properly put over Sting when Sting's ready at Great American Bash. How, if you're not Jim Herd, are you not pleading with Muda to say, we'll go with you as the guy on top for the next 3 months? This part right here to me just boggles my mind. I never to this day understood it, because Muda knew as soon as that happened, and he was like, you know what, if you're not really going to do anything with me, I'll go back to Japan and start my career proper, and then the Three Musketeers were born the next year. So just still, you know, Jim Herd made some good decisions, so to speak, but I still think Muda's the play here, and I always think Muda's the play here.
And of course, Gary Hart had denied before he passed away that he ever told Muda that a Japanese guy couldn't get over as a babyface in the States.
Right. Well, there you go. So there is.
And that, yeah. He said they split because there was a dispute over that whatever the booking was going to be for the Dome shows, which was originally going to be Muda versus Flair.
Right.
Before WCW and Flair pulled out, that it was that, like, Hart was going to be there with them, and then WCW had their disagreement with New Japan, and that Muda said he wasn't going to go, and that led to their split. And who knows?
That would have been a great place to do the change, is at the Tokyo Dome.
Right. Why not? Just, you have that built in. You know, he's on his home turf. He's in front of his fans, right? You know, and they tried that a year later with Fujinami, and it didn't go over nearly as well. And it's like, you have the perfect, like, absolutely wrapped, you know, guy who can do this angle and do it well. You'll draw two good houses out of it, and then you'll, you know, and good, you know, good money on the loops, and then you can go right back to Sting when he's ready at Great American Bash, and everybody's happy.
And like, I don't go back to Japan. You don't even need to have any, like, lasting repercussions from it.
No. Muda drops the title, and you send him off into the sunset with an injury angle or something like that, and that's it. You don't hear from him again. Yeah. I don't get it. As soon as I was looking over the notes for the show that you guys put together, I was like, that should have been the play. That really should have been the play.
And but it's just Flair's book,
right? And that's the thing. It was like Flair, and I don't know what Flair's thoughts on Muda were at the time. I don't really think he had thoughts on Muda too much. You know, they faced each other at Starrcade in the Iron Man tourney.
And we saw how that went.
Yeah, and that wasn't exactly – and I think that's kind of why Flair didn't really think of Muda too much. But it's like, you had it built in here. Muda was obviously the guy who you didn't have to worry about turning Luger again so quickly. You know, you could have had 3 months with Muda and him winning the belt in Japan, and then him dropping it in April to set up Great American Bash in July. I mean, there's way too many things here that got overlooked just because, you know, Flair didn't have the ideas about Muda being a top guy in his head. So,
yeah. Well, to finish off the clash, they did a 4.5 rating with a 6.8 share, which was slightly lower than the two previous clashes and roughly the same as the clash from last February. Considering the weekly TV ratings have been higher than they have been in years, this rating should not be called a big success, but it can be described as decent.
Also, to be fair, though, wasn't the previous clash the most watched match in the history of cable television up to that point? Or the media was?
Yeah. Speaking of those ratings, the TV ratings, Power Hour on February 2nd did a 2.7, WCW did a 3.6 on Saturday the 3rd, and Main Event did a 3.1 on Sunday the 4th. Which is impressive considering it was joined in progress 15 minutes to the show, and that the NBA game before it only did a 1.7 rating.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were doing really solid ratings at this time on television.
Yeah.
And that would quickly change.
Yes, it would.
They'd peak a couple weeks later, and yeah.
Yeah. All right, now let's go to non-clash news. The NWA will begin drug testing its wrestlers at the end of February, but nothing in detail has been told to anyone about this and or what drugs will be tested.
I wonder why.
The speculation among the wrestlers, though, is that this will be like the WWF's test, where they mainly test for cocaine.
I wonder what the catalyst for that was.
Yeah, since the test date is going to be known in advance, it gives the wrestlers a chance to clean themselves up because the cocaine metabolite doesn't stay in your system for more than a few days. Testing for marijuana, though, could reveal usage much farther back, while steroid testing basically depends on what drugs you use and your own system, plus if masking drugs have been used. All right, Bix, what are your thoughts about this little drug testing thing here?
Why are you asking me?
Well, you know all about all these the drug test stuff.
I do? Okay.
Okay.
You cover MMA. You should know all about that.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't. It's 25 years later, 26 years later. I don't know.
But we still have this stuff going on, in MMA, wrestling.
Oh, yeah. Even if it was a few years ago, we still heard about coke.
Right.
And the whole thing was that guys would do coke on Tuesdays after SmackDown because they were usually tested at TVs. So if you wanted to do coke, you could do it after SmackDown, and you knew that you weren't being tested till at least Monday, or even if it was a house show, you still had time.
Yeah.
And of course, then Jimmy Yang had his birthday. Celebrated, I'm making air quotes, after. And he scratched his nose in a shoot interview when he told the story.
Yeah.
And then tested positive. And also, his birthday was on a Tuesday that year.
There you go.
I'm not making that up, by the way.
What timing?
Yeah.
But, yeah, drug testing and wrestling, always comedy of errors.
Well, especially WCW drug testing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the famous story is the Gordon Sully story.
Wait, I don't know that one. Do tell.
We told this. Sid talking about that Gordon Sully was standing in line with him at the drug test. No, Sid was there. Gordon Sully was one getting tested. And I'm trying to remember how it went. But Gordon Sully made a joke
about
that.
That's a great start. That's a great start to this story.
Gordon Sully made a joke about drinking a bunch of screwdrivers on an airplane or something.
Yeah, I'm sure that was a joke.
It wasn't a joke, but just the visual of the huge wrestlers, and there's Gordon Sully getting tested. Which, you know, he was a drunk anyway, so they had good reason to test. Well, it's the truth.
How long would it be that he would even test positive for everything? I mean, it's alcohol.
Who knows? There's a great moment, real quick, on Gordon Sully. Going way back, on one of the, I think it was George Championship Wrestling, and before they did the switch in 82, there's a quick cut from the camera to Gordon when it wasn't supposed to. And Gordon's at the podium, and you see him drinking vodka or drinking some type of alcoholic beverage, you know, in a glass on ice. And he quickly puts it down.
Well, if it's vodka, you've got plausible deniability, though.
Oh, man.
So he was drinking when doing commentary on Saturday mornings. So that tells you something right there. All right. A FedEx letter was reportedly mailed to the NWA last week threatening legal action against the company on behalf of Paul Heyman, who had been fired by Ric Flair in September. Heyman is still in a dispute over the settlement of his monetary terms for the last 5 months of his contract when he was dismissed. The letter was said to have cited the NWA for wrongful firing and charges them with false advertising for showing Heyman's old wrestling hotline commercials during recent TBS shows, as well as during the airing of Gator, the Burt Reynolds classic, in January. Sources told Matt Watch that Heyman's lawyers are giving the NWA 5 days to respond before filing suit in New York federal court. Matt Watch tried to reach out to Jim Herd, but was unsuccessful. And speaking of Heyman, The Torch reported that he had an open-door offer from the WWF to join them by March 15th, but it looked like he wasn't going to go there at this point in his career. Heyman is either thinking of starting his own promotion or waiting for Flair to be removed from power in WCW so he could come back. And Tim, we know what eventually ended up happening here.
That's right. There's a nice little settlement check for old Paul there. In with
and then
all
Flair came back, and then Flair was removed from power, and he came back.
The flush of Paul. More than one settlement check from Pipistrello.
There you go. Yeah, and Paul made mention of this, and he talked in the great documentary for I Am Paul Heyman that was put together last year, or actually end of 2014 now. And he talked about it in pretty broad terms because he couldn't go into specifics. But the idea is the money from this and other checks is what allowed him to start up ECW. And he had talked about it. He said that one of the things he was considering with some of the people he's talking to was starting up a promotion because of his promoter friends in New York and New Jersey at the time. And
I thought that was the other settlement, though. I don't think that was this one.
Well, I can't remember which one he said was the catalyst for starting ECW, but
the second one was when he got involved there. But right. this one was a good one too.
Yes, it was. Yeah, and it kept him, and that was why he decided to wait it out and not go back for the time he did, because he could definitely live off of that settlement for a while. So, that whole thing was all messed up. I know Paul and Flair didn't really get along that well, and you know, as soon as Flair came back in '93, you know, Paul was out the door, not too long after. So, it was kind of an odd time. And this is just throws into the turmoil of NWA at this time. Is you know, you have that going on. You have Flair as your booker and your champion, and you know, and Herd just trying to do everything he can to keep that in line, and just shit falling apart all around him. Just a totally toxic atmosphere.
And Paul at this time, Bix, of course, was in ICW.
He was the booker.
Managing and booking for the Savoldis. The Wrestling School Dropout gimmick was going strong there.
Which would eventually be reused for Mikey Whipwreck.
Which would be used for Mikey Whipwreck. But this Paul started his own promotion deal. Remember when we did the show from the last show we did from this time period, late 89, early 90, was to talk about the Continental time slots.
And trying to start his new, what would we call this, a confederation?
Booking office.
Yeah. It would be, of promotions. Yeah.
So here we go in February. That same thoughts in his mind. So,
right. And by the way, did you find out, like I did, who ended up getting those time slots?
Yes. Bo James told me. Would you go ahead and tell everyone?
Ron West, because his name was on Ron all West. The contracts.
And I remember that from reading The Observer, because Ron West ran Chattanooga area, and it was North American Championship Wrestling was the name of the promotion, but they only ran shows for like a month. Very, very limited amount of shows they ran. And then they lost out a lot of money. But yeah, that's what happened to those time slots. But Heyman was wanting to do a promotion back then. And, of course, and eventually we know what would happen. But Paul Heyman and lawsuits, Bix, kind of go together, don't they? Hand in hand.
What does that mean?
Well, he just known for a lot of lawsuits and his dad's lawyer. So,
and,
I mean,
and other things.
Well, you know, I wasn't going to bring that up. I'll let you do it since you're one of the tribe.
Oh, God. No, but seriously, though, so there's this, there's then he sues WCW after they fire him for allegedly, what would be the best word for this, misappropriating travel funds?
Yeah, and I got legal action by ECW once, so.
I mean, there are a lot of, wait, what? Say that again?
I got threatened by ECW one time by legal action.
Explain.
I thought I told this story before on the show.
I don't remember this.
When we had our... me and my brother had our public access show.
Mm-hmm.
We would show like a Matt classic of the week, quote unquote. And one of the matches we showed was the first Ray Psicosis match. And of course we showed this in 98, mm-hmm. but it was 95. So we said that we kind of played loose with it being a classic, but we were basically telling everybody, all right, you see how Ray and Psicosis work in WCW. Here's how they were in another environment. So we showed that match. Well, somehow word got to ECW, and my producer got a phone call from Paul Heyman's father threatening legal action if we ever showed anything from ECW again on our television show. So there you go.
Dang.
ECW would never use anything without permission on their television, like music or anything like that.
Never.
Public access show in Barnesville, Georgia. But
my goodness.
I have a theory on how that happened, but I'm not going to talk about it on the air. So, but anyway, moving on. Starting at the Clash, the Turner's marketing department was forcing the name change from NWA to World Championship Wrestling, as they think the NWA name has more negatives than positives and brings up images in the fans' minds that they are inferior. Now, Biggs,
that's an odd one.
That's an interesting wording there. That was from Dave, and yeah, I mean, just weird. I mean, I could understand what they mean, because the NWA was Crockett and they went out of business, but I think that was kind of like, this was felt like too inside.
Well, the fan, most of the fans didn't know that.
Yeah, no, so I say it was too inside thinking.
And they didn't do it till the end of the year anyway.
Right. Yeah,
they started, but they started to incorporate the name change throughout the year.
They, they really started to do it.
And they changed the ring aprons. Yeah, they changed the ring aprons in '90 to have the World Championship Wrestling on there. They had the World Championship Wrestling banners, that purple and gold. I mean, they were definitely starting World Championship Wrestling. Remember the long banners that would be in the arenas that was hanging across. I mean, they were definitely changing the name.
And then I think it was the last weekend of 1990. We're all watching WCW main event on Sunday evening. I mean, we're watching main event on Sunday evening, and there's the opening. The opening ends, and all of a sudden says WCW main event instead of WWE main event.
Yeah,
which I think the syndicated shows also changed the same weekend, but I'm guessing for most people that's how they found out.
Yes. So yeah. It was what it was.
It is what it is.
I remember the marketing part of this. It was the NWA presents World Championship Wrestling. Like that was part of this marketing.
In the house show ads.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's basically what they did throughout the '90s through 1990, I should say, was it was presenting World Championship Wrestling by the NWA, which was really odd and didn't help with marketing branding. It's like TNA Impact Wrestling. It's like that, it doesn't work that way.
Well, a lot of this had to do with the whole title situation as well,
right? Which in the next 18 months becomes very interesting.
Yes. Now the Road Warriors held an impromptu press conference, which I'm curious to know if this actually happened or if it was just a bunch of people standing around on the Texas Swing, where they said they were quote fed up with the NWA unquote and wanted to go to WWF or Japan. And it beating up tougher guys in back alleys in the skyscrapers. And, of course, Tim, you know, they were gone about 4 months later.
Yeah, they go work for Ricky Tenryu, you know, in SWS. And
Ricky Tenryu?
Yeah. No, that's the JBL. That's the JBL.
Yeah. Okay.
Because he always calls him Ricky Tenryu. He decides to cross up Ricky Choshu and Genichiro Tenryu and calls him Ricky Tenryu, so I thought I'd get that joke in there. This also puts quite a dent in the idea of Mark Calloway, greatest kangaroo court judge of all time. You know, like he was not yet the enforcer that he would come to be later on in his WWF. So this is
taking a shot
there, the Road Warriors.
So yeah, what do you think this press conference was, though?
I don't know. It's just weird wording there when I saw it. And that was in Matt Watch. That's just weird wording. I guess, like I said, a bunch of guys standing around.
Were there any Texas-based newsletter writers at that time?
Well, they had Texas Roundup was still around then, wasn't it? So
it didn't start a little later in the year.
A bunch of guys in cowboy hats. The security team from the Sportatorium was probably who it was, or something like that.
Yeah.
So
they went to a country music bar, and that's where they did the press conference.
So. Yeah. Speaking of skyscrapers, Sid Vicious has re-upped for another year, so that should quell the rumors of him going to the WWF. Vicious is supposed to return on June 1st, with Terry Funk visiting Jim Herd and told him that his recovery from his punctured lung was looking good. Yeah, Terry Funk was visiting Sid Vicious and gave the word to Jim Herd. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Terry Funk doing the hospital visits, or where, not hospital, but just visiting guys for Herd, which is odd.
Well, he was a television producer, so.
Yeah.
I guess.
And, of course, when Sid came back, he was shooting into the Horsemen, although not to Flair's liking. But, I mean, you could definitely see where WWF was linked to him. Sure. And, of course, if we go there the next year, because, you know, we talk about Sid so many times on the show. I mean, he just fit what they wanted. Now, Owen Hart and Buddy Landell both have offers from the NWA and WWF, with Dave thinking both men would be better off not going to the WWF, as Owen should already know what his status would be, and Landell would be nothing more than a low carder. Now, Bix, Owen, of course, did go the next year, and Buddy was in NWA a few months later.
And maybe, yeah, and, I mean, this is, I'm curious why, well, A, like, Owen just left the WWF.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, Buddy, I mean, I would think would be used, I'm guessing they wanted him to replace Tim Horner.
Not as babyface.
No, but as in, as a, I mean, maybe even that. I mean, but as a, as you know, as your guy who's like technically maybe more than a jobber, but like, I'm trying to remember, did Tim Horner do TV jobs during his run, or did he mostly work house shows?
He worked on television. I bet Buddy would have been like a Black Bart type role.
Okay, well, that's the, it's kind of the same thing, though. It's the heel version of the Tim Horner role. And also, and like maybe Al Perez. Well, wait, was Al Perez already in WWE?
Al Perez is a good call. Yeah, he would have been like an Al Perez. Yes, that's a good. He wouldn't have been like another guy we'll talk about later on the show who got brought in around this time period, but he would have been like an Al Perez type guy.
When did Al Perez come in? It wasn't long after this, right?
No, it was in 1990. So. Yeah, but Owen in this time period in NWA would have been cool.
Yes. I mean, I don't see Buddy fitting in WWF.
No.
Not even close.
No, he definitely made the right decision not to go. But speaking of guys that were coming in, Dutch Mantel is heading in here with plans that he would start a permanent team with Tommy Rich. Huh. Now, Tim, the plan was that they were talking about with they were going to do Muda and Sawyer versus Dutch and Rich as a feud. I would have loved that. But that's what that was what Muda
say
was
say that
upset.
Again. I was transfixed by your ringtone again.
Yeah, then once a show. Muda was upset with that because he thought that was a downgrade.
Yeah, right. And we were talking about how, you know, he basically didn't think they had any ideas for him. But could you imagine the Dutch versus Buzz Sawyer promos at this time? Could you imagine that on TV? My God, please. Oh, man. That would have been great. Yeah.
And then Dutch not only used as a prelim wrestler, but also an announcer.
Right.
With Tony Schiavone on Worldwide. Which they were a really interesting team. I thought they were pretty good together. And set, of course, set the template for Dutch and Bob Caudle to smoke him out. But, yeah, Dutch did come in. And Tommy and Dutch had been a team before. They were Southern Tag Champs in Memphis.
That's right.
So they would have been good together as a team.
And it took me a second to remember it, but last time Dutch had been in effectively this promotion, he was a babyface.
With Bobby Jaggers as one of the Kansas Jayhawks.
Yeah.
So
it's not that left field.
No. He would have.
It'd been fun. Now, another guy who knows Dutch Mantel well, Doug Furness, was on TV over the weekend, but he worked as a babyface since head booker Flair changed his mind once he saw him work. So Flair wanted Furness to be a heel to begin with, and then watching him work changed his mind. That's interesting.
Which is weird because he was a much better heel than a babyface.
he was kind of at the time like a not a low rent Lex Luger, but he was a Lex Luger ish guy. Great, you know, great physique, great body, very athletic. But he's like the guy who could just do everything better than you. And it was weird. I think like Flair saw his offense. It was like, you have way better babyface offense. Which is, you know, I can see that, but yeah, it's like, it's obvious once he goes to Japan. It's like, yeah, he should have been a heel there. So.
Yeah. And this is a time period where Furness, where, you know, he was really getting over and start in Japan with Crawford.
Right.
And everybody was wondering why he couldn't get over in America, Bix. And it was just one of those deals where he wasn't the best promo in the world, and Booker's just didn't know how to use him right.
Yeah, I mean, what they really should have done, I mean, was something along the lines of what it looked like WWE was going to do towards the end of his run there that they didn't do, was to put him, like, because they were teasing putting him in LaFon with Cornette.
Yeah, he needed a talker. Yeah.
And he was, you know, it's like Bobby Eaton. Bobby Eaton, great in-ring heel.
Mm-hmm.
Just couldn't, you know, wasn't a promo guy. It just wasn't him. But, you know, could absolutely, you know, and same thing for, you know, LaFon / Crawford, that he was, you know, great, great, great heel wrestler. And I mean, maybe to a point it wouldn't translate to the American style. I kind of doubt that, but, you know, and then finally when they did work his heels in the States, I mean, it was the end of their run. So, I mean, I don't think it's that necessarily their fault that they just weren't clicking then.
Yeah, just time and place for them to. This is a good story. Ring announcer Tony Gillum, who, if you remember from WCW television, was a guy with the blonde hair, is currently suspended for a few weeks because he made some announcements while the Samoans were doing a post-match brawl. So basically the promotion was pissed off at him because, you know, he wasn't putting over the brawl as a ring announcer. He was trying to announce, I guess, the next card or something, whatever details they needed to announce, Bix.
But yeah, brawl going on, and then he's just like, wrestling fans?
Now, Tim, I think Gillum only mainly worked like the Georgia tapings.
Yeah, he was sparingly used. He was a guy that you would hear sometimes. Like, did he do any Omni shows? He didn't do any of the big. Yeah, he probably did some
Omni shows. Yeah.
Yeah. So he.
Capetta didn't do the Omni stuff.
Right. And so he was a guy that did Omni shows, and they went to Marietta or something like that. He'd do those.
Yeah, he was the Marietta guy.
Right.
They were Cobb County. It was him. Capetta would come in every now and then, but. Yeah, Gillum was like the local Georgia guy.
Well, right.
Why did they stop using Rhubarb Jones?
I think the feeling was Rhubarb was too country.
Because his name was Rhubarb Jones.
Well, Rhubarb, you listen to him talk, you'll get why. But
I mean, he's accented, but I thought it added to his.
I did too, and I love Rhubarb, but
he's not that heavily accented.
But you know how corporate wrestling is.
Right.
I mean, it's the same company that was sending Missy Hyatt, and we talked about it on this show, to speech lesson so she could sound less Southern.
Yeah, that went well.
That totally went well.
So, I mean, this is what they do. I mean, Vince has that to this day, and this stigma. Kevin Dunn hates accents. So,
yeah.
It's just pettiness in wrestling.
Have you heard Ardo O'Call talk lately? Edwards?
Sounds like a different man. So not even the same guy. So, yeah, they hate the accents. All right, Lex Luger and Sting are now business partners as they were to sign papers last week for joint ownership of a gym in Cincinnati and looking for others, which this would be Main Event Fitness, and they would own multiple ones in the Metro Atlanta area, make good money on it, and you know, Flair's talked about that their success, you know, motivated him to go into business with Gold's Gym. Mm-hmm. And these were pretty big deal picks. I knew a lot of people in that era that used to work out at Main Event Fitness.
Yeah, I remember it was like one of those, how do you put it? Like one of those things that it's like not trivia. Do you know what, trying to get what I'm getting at though?
Yeah, I know. I kind of,
it was like a thing to know.
Yeah. And it would be brought up. You know, Jim Ross would bring it up on commentary when Luger and Sting were like friends.
Right.
And even I think when Luger turned, it was brought up how these men owned a business together.
Yeah, I think they did. Yeah.
So, yeah, it was definitely it was a deal that it was played to the locals, but it was, you know, known nationally.
Yeah, and I remember, I think it was the Torch them covering. I don't remember. So it was, I guess it would have been when I subscribed. So like 94, 95. There was an ad locally where they were dressed as babies in diapers.
Yeah, I remember that.
What was that like?
Weird. weird.
Maybe now we know what kind of wild stuff Sting was into before he found Jesus.
Oh boy, you're gonna give me a go off on a deal, but you listen to that Talking Sheep midweek podcast.
Oh god,
on that. All right, WRAL in Raleigh, which was the original home for Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, dropped NWA Pro, which had been airing at 1 a.m. on Sundays. NWA had only had WLFL in the Raleigh Durham area now. This comes off the heels, though, of Carl and Elliot Murnick switching their promotional allegiance from the NWA to the WWF, and that they could convince TV stations to switch as well, especially in Charlotte and Greensboro. Also, to avoid problems with the new syndicated exclusivity rules, NWA will produce a separate NWA pro show just for WPIX in New York with Jim Ross and Michael Hayes as the announcers. And Vix, you know, you watched that show. I've seen stuff from that show. It was different. But first off, if we talk about that, talk about the – it's an interesting deal with the Murnies because
yeah,
they were –
yeah, I had no idea this lifers. Happened until we –
yeah, they were lifers with this promotion with the, you know, the Crockett Promotions and then this promotion. And that was a big deal because WRL is where they taped. But if you watch the old NWA television shows pre September 1981, and you notice the difference in how the shows were taped, because once they moved to Charlotte to WCPQ Studios, the shows were taped from the angle, the right corner angle of the ring, where on the other shows, like if you watched Wahoo getting his leg broken, Flair and Steamboat, that first match, you know, so it was straight down the middle.
Yes.
That was WRL. So, I mean, the history there is so big. This was a big deal in that area.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess it's not, I mean, yeah, that's off the station. Although like in practice, it's Pro, which is the show that at this point is starting to be treated as if it's in a different universe from everything else in the promotion.
Yes.
So in the grand scheme of things, in terms of like what people are seeing, it's not the end of the world, especially if they're on like, was WLFL an equivalent station, like in terms of reach?
Let me see if those call letters are still in existence.
It's not like they had a good time slot for Pro either.
They were a UHF station.
LFL? What channel number does it say?
22.
And RAL.
They're now a CW affiliate.
Oh, of course they are.
And to, of course, WRAL, they've just been in the news lately because they switched over from CBS, and they're going to be an NBC affiliate on the 29th of February. And it's a huge deal.
That stuff doesn't happen much anymore.
Yeah. In fact, there is a it rarely happens, but it's a huge deal in that market. But go ahead.
Now, as far as the Murnicks were still NWA members, though, for the next few years, weren't they?
Yes, we talked about that in the NWA stuff in 1993.
Which is also weird because they were associate promoters in the – you know, I mean, there was no reason they should be members in the first place. They did not have a booking office.
No, they didn't.
They should have been associates. Like, so I don't understand the whole deal there. I never knew this happened. I figured if they were members, they were still with WCW the whole time, so – is this when WWF starts to make inroads into the Carolinas?
Yes. Yeah, this is about to say, like, this is the time where Vince starts offering the awesome syndicate deals to stations to air their content, pre-produced and stuff like that, and they don't have to really worry about too much, and he ends up buying a lot of these time slots that the NWA had for a long time.
You know, and we talked about this with World Class in Dallas when they took KTVT
right
over, you know, and Tim in your area, you know, we right. talked about San Francisco. Yeah. In our previous show that was going on. And, you know, they were WCW was supposed to do a San Francisco centric edition of the Pro.
Right.
But I don't think it ever happened.
No, I'm trying to remember. There was, you know, it was very TBS centric, but as far as syndicated shows go, it was mainly WWF at the time. But there were, I know that, you know, there were still ideas of, you know, WWF wasn't huge in the Bay Area. There were still some ties to the NWA in the Bay Area, obviously. And so with the AWA having left San Francisco kind of became a Wild West of types of whoever was going to kind of get the syndicated rights there. And I haven't looked too much into it. I probably should, considering I grew up watching wrestling here. But I just know that once the AWA stopped running San Francisco, which was 87, 88, I want to say, that it basically it was up for grabs. And I'm not sure what the time frame was before WWF kind of owned the syndicated stuff there.
What are the odds that the reason that there was no Pro Wrestling San Francisco was that they shot it, it had Jim Barnett as host, and was immediately rejected by the TV station?
Oh,
what would you expect from this company? Seriously.
Put it on the board. Put it on the board. Give me 3 to 5 odds. I mean, that's pretty much it. Like, oh, let's put Jim Barnett in San Francisco.
I mean, let's face it. Even if Paul Heyman wasn't from New York, he would have been the co-host of Pro Wrestling New York.
Well, it started out with Michael Hayes, though, here, Bix. And I didn't know that Michael Hayes was on the original NWA Pro. Well, Heyman wasn't there yet, but I didn't know that.
What's his real last name?
Sites.
What would people in WCW think?
Jew.
Yeah.
The idea of Jim Barnett hosting the San Francisco-based pro shows is a good idea as Ring of Honor running the actual Cow Palace during that one the infamous Cow Palace show. God.
Yeah. Now, Pro Wrestling. Now, Chris, did you get PIX in Atlanta?
No, I've seen it on tapes.
Okay.
Like WCW stuff I've gotten from people like John McAdam and stuff like that was off of Pro New York. I had Pro Chicago.
You mean certain tape dealers from New Hampshire.
Well, he's a retired. he's retired, so we can say his name.
I guess.
But,
so.
Besides,
he doesn't exist online.
Yeah, he doesn't exist anymore. I did get the Pro Chicago show. We had it called WGN. So, but yeah, I didn't have PIX. So that was kind of interesting to watch that show, matches that was seen on that show, but with Heyman instead of who was on in Chicago.
Yeah. And the tragedy of all of this is that because so many people got PIX or WGN instead of getting the actual regular syndicated version of Pro, means that that version, which is the best version with Lance Russell and the Freebirds, is there's not a lot of tape of it around.
Yeah.
Well, there's a certain tape dealer in New York that got it from a Western Pennsylvania affiliate, which has the Lance Russell Freebird.
My understanding was that almost all of his stuff was from New York or Chicago.
Well, the ones I have has the Lance. Because I have the entire Fabulous Freebirds gold record deal and all that stuff.
Oh, God.
Are they from this person's main WCW TV list, or are they from a separate section?
They are from the main list.
Okay.
And it has the angle of the gold record, the angle of the tape where they're supposed to have the concert in Germany.
Well, right, yeah. That's the thing, too, because it's missing angles on the New York and Chicago shows because...
because they ran their own angle.
Yeah, then...
Yeah.
So
anyway, moving into the last subject of this, and this is interesting because we talked about this before in the show as well. Jim Ross mentioned that Buzz Sawyer would be appearing on the Arsenio Hall show on TV over the weekend, which was news to Arsenio's people. Several wrestlers were told that Sawyer was going on there, not as an NWA guy, but doing something regarding his wrestling school. The NWA Arsenio talks have been going on for a while, with many conflicting stories, with one being that they wanted Ric Flair on the show in April. But the NWA didn't cooperate with them. And Jim Herd, though, told Steve Beverly that it was a complete lie, and they would be, quote, damn fools if they turned that opportunity down, unquote. And, yeah, we talked about Arsenio was a haven for WWF guys, but the rumors was that Arsenio, being a guy from Cleveland, was more of an NWA guy.
Can you imagine Buzz Sawyer on the Arsenio Hall show?
My God, yes.
Stretching jobbers. That's a form of a wrestling school bit.
No, they'd probably play up the Mag Dog thing to appeal to the
Mag Dog
pals.
Yeah, I was about to say, they'd have him on a collar and leash and stuff like that. Exactly, right. Oh, man.
I guess Rick Steiner would be the best one for that.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Without a doubt.
But Rick Steiner wasn't like a complete psychotic like Buzz Sawyer was.
He wasn't?
Well, not like Buzz Sawyer was at this time. Let's put it that way.
At any time.
Yeah, Bustle Ray was next level.
Yeah, if you stick a gun in Rick Steiner's mouth, I don't see him just laughing in your face.
Oh, God. This reading this is reminding me of the AWA on Donahue back in 81, where they had the panel interview. Did you guys remember that from the AWA?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. God damn. Wrestling and talk shows doesn't get any better than that.
And by the way, I have not watched it all the way through yet, but that Mr. Moop or whatever his name is on YouTube with all the talk show clips and stuff, one of the things he's uploaded is Sherry and Zeus on Arsenio.
Which we talked about on this show.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I did mention that. Yeah. So.
We talked about that on this show when that
it was
one of the weeks.
Showed up on YouTube because of No Holds Barred. Yeah.
Yeah.
That I really should watch that because that should be special.
Yes.
Oh, you would. I would think so. I mean, Zeus, Sherry, come on.
Got to watch that.
And now we're going to go to our international section as we don't have a whole lot this week. Japan's on tour and not a lot going on in Mexico and whatever. All right. We go to FMW, which is in its infancy stages. They've only been around for about a year. And one of their big stars is leaving as Masashi Oyagi is leaving the promotion to go to work for Ryuma Go's Pioneer promotion. But there's no word on when Go will run another car. Now, Bix, we watched this stuff, the 1989 stuff for the Other Japan part of the Best of the 80s Death by Driver set. And FMW and Pioneer were very interesting at this time period. Not what you would expect.
Well, in what way do you mean that?
Well, FMW was not into the death matches and all that stuff yet. And Pioneer was kind of both of them were really kind of like hybrid promotions, as you would say. They're kind of like more of a karate thing going on.
And that's really because of Aoyagi.
Yeah.
So for those who don't know, FMW started as the whole Frontier Martial Arts wrestling name is because of the Onita versus Aoyagi, and then their various stable mates, also Tarzan Goto versus Mr. Danger. Getting his name all
Mitsuhiro Matsunaga.
Mitsuhiro Matsunaga. Stuff because like Aoyagi was like you can argue that Aoyagi was really the draw more than Onita on those early shows.
Yes.
Because, like, 60% of the crowd was his karate students.
Yes.
Who were there thinking that he was shooting on Onita.
Yes.
That's why those matches are so heated.
Yeah, I mean, they were definitely into him.
And it's probably also why they were the main event of the second Ikikajuwara Memorial, because the promoters of that were, Ishii from... that started K1 later because it was his karate organization that was promoting the shows. So who's better to be in the main event than Aoyagi? So this is, on paper, it's a big blow to FMW.
Yes. And this is when they kind of switch it up, Tim, where they start bringing in more of that style of guys to go more hardcore. After Aoyagi left.
Right. And, this is mainly because Onita messed his knee up so much that he really, the shoot style kind of stuff he was working at the time, the first year of FMW, it didn't allow him to work the junior style that, he was brought up with in All Japan. And so, he had to figure out the next step after Aoyagi decides to leave. And really the only thing he could think of is let's be, this brawling company. In the vein of your Puerto Rican, promotions. And, then of course, a couple years later, Terry Funk, just the wandering where he is, does, the big death match with Onita, and all of a sudden, FMW has the following it does.
Yeah. Now, sources were telling Dave Meltzer that Tatsumi Fujinami is planning on opening a new wrestling office called the, quote, Dragon Family, unquote, and that some of the wrestlers that will be jumping to his group are Masakatsu Funaki, Jushin Thunder Liger, Shiro Koshinaka, Akira Nogami, and Takayuki Iizuka. The report is that this group will become an independent office and that the wrestlers as a group will also work for other promotions. In fact, the plan is for this group to work with every promotion in the country except the UWF. Fujinami told reporters at the Tokyo Dome on February 10th that he would be returning to action this year, but would not comment on the office story.
A few years early, Dave.
Yeah, right.
Quite a few years early, but Tim, that's an interesting deal there because Funaki is the only guy that's not a New Japan guy.
Right.
He was a UWF guy and was starting to, you know, make waves in that promotion. But
he had been a New Japan guy.
Yeah. Of course, he had been a New Japan Trueborn. But think about how different a lot of Japanese wrestling would be if this came off the ground.
Yeah, I mean, Liger had just beaten Sano for the belt. This is, you know, 2 weeks after that. Koshinaka was you know, a little bit older than your Three Musketeer guys, but he was obviously highly regarded as a junior before moving up. Nogami was right there with Liger as kind of his rival, and Iizuka was a guy who was kind of like a Funaki light in a lot of ways. And so, you know, I do find it interesting that they decided to work with everyone except for UWF. I think,
and All Japan's name was prominently mentioned in
Right, and the idea, you know, All Japan and New Japan, you know, were definitely separated at the time, and were still bad blood probably going all the way back to Hanson.
Well, this time there was more thawing because they worked together,
right?
On dome shows,
right? I mean, if it happened, it would have definitely changed the junior side of New Japan without a doubt, because Liger was their guy, and you know, he was obviously primed as the guy to lead the entire division. And, you know, juniors weren't a big draw at the time in New Japan, but Liger was definitely over. I think it would have been interesting. And Funaki was, you know, a riser at the time, and he decided to go on his own shoot route throughout the 90s, and he worked all over the place. But I don't know. I kind of feel like if it did get off the ground, you know, it could have been interesting. But I guess my question is, were there tensions between Fujinami and New Japan at the time? Was it based around his return from injury? Because I know he got hurt pretty bad and such, but I don't know if was there any tension there? I can't remember this time frame too well for New Japan.
Fujinami had ups and downs politically in that company.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a time period where Seiji Sakaguchi is really starting to get entrenched.
Right.
As Inoki is now a politician.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm sure there was something going on behind the scenes.
Right. Right. Yeah, because, I mean, he was out almost the entirety of 89 and into 90.
Back injury.
With the back stuff. And there was questions about when he did come back and what, you know, what capacity could he come back. And, you know, and then that's where they pulled the plug on the Three Musketeers and pushed those guys forward, and it turned out to be the right move. I don't know. I think it could have done something. I don't know how long it would have lasted, to be honest with you. But it definitely could have been interesting. It was because 1990, there was still some isolationist stuff between New Japan and All Japan. You said it, they're a thawing because they did work on some shows together. But I don't know, Gaijin, right? Yeah, you know, but I don't know how much of an impact something like this would have worked. It would have been great for Fujinami though, because one of the things for this type of promotion does, working with multiple promotions, is that it keeps fresh matchups going, and you can do that. You can do that around the loop for a couple of years and still have some big time matchups. And you know, with Tenryu a couple months later going to, you know, split off and start SWS and all this stuff coming down the pike, you know, there definitely could have been some money made. I really do think so. But I think it really would have only affected New Japan on the junior side, if anything.
And that's a good point, Biggs. I think that if this happens, this is a total hypothetical, if this happens, Tenryu splits off, yeah, they hook up.
Right. Yeah. They're the first thing that happens, basically.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I'm thinking, like, seeing this, even though this doesn't happen, and the FMW stuff, why is this the very beginning of the whole indie era in Japan anyway? Like, why was there really nothing until the middle of 89?
I think it's the money backing. I'm pretty
that's
sure
a big part of it.
Is that UWF really being, all it was that they were just
UWF being successful at the Tokyo Dome without television?
Mm-hmm.
That's what does it,
right? That's
because you got to remember the UWF, the first incarnation, you know, died, and it was two promotions until Maeda left, you know, until he was fired, and then what these people saw, you know, had their success, like, well, there's room here to compete.
Yeah. I guess that makes sense, then.
And you just had to wait for the right guys, you know, and like, and then, you know, Tenryu jumping to form SWS definitely showed that, you know, things could be done. So, I mean, right. And then, of course, everything sprouted up later on.
Well, but, and I ask because it's not just Onita. I mean, because, you know, there's Gran Hamada's whole role during this, where he's pretty much on the outside looking in when it comes to mainstream Japanese
wrestling. Yeah, and he's just now getting going, planning his promotion. And in fact, one thing I didn't put in the notes was the rumor was that Hamada was talking to Fujinami as well about using him and his crew on the Universal shows.
Right.
So,
Which makes sense because if he has all those junior heavyweights, they'd fit in well with his crew.
And
the luchadors.
Yeah. So,
and then another thing too is this is just the beginning of the Joshi side sprouting off into independence too, because of the mandatory retirement ages in All Japan Women and these women who still want to wrestle after the retirement period's done. And so a couple years later, that leads to the big interpromotional stuff. So, it's interesting to see why like this spider web effect happens with all these independent promotions really in only like a 2 year span. This happens. Just all these places just start up like that.
And in Onita's case, I mean, a lot of it's luck because originally it seemed like FMW was going to start with Onita versus Hamada being the main feud.
Yeah.
Which is this forgotten thing because it was Hamada was the referee and trainer for the original JWP.
Mm-hmm.
And just completely on the outside of everything, like I mentioned, because he had left New Japan, he had left All Japan, first UWF died, so like I guess he's sort of blackballed, and they do the thing angle where Onita attacks him, nothing comes of it, and then again to go back to Oyagi, I mean Oyagi you can even argue is the big catalyst for the indie movement because he was also working with Ryu Mago on the Pioneer shows.
Yeah, and then a jump to New Japan in 1990.
Yeah.
So,
but his presence, because he had that fan base, I guess, of the students and everything, is a big part of why the indie movement started in the first place.
Yeah. Go bigger.
Well, speaking of indie movements, Canada. If the rumors of Stampede Wrestling closing shop didn't seem true, well, it was basically confirmed this week that Stu Hart is selling all of his old rings. Now, also on February the 7th, the CNWA, the promotion started by Stampede TV producer Fred May to fill Stu's old time slots, held their second TV taping at the Silver Dollar Action Center in Calgary. And in an ad for the show that was included in Tom Burke's Global Wrestling News Service newsletter, the only name promoted was, wait for it, announcer Ed Whalen. The true star of the show, Bix. Ed Whalen. Ring a ding dong dandy.
Him in his wig.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But have you ever seen any of the CNWA, Bix?
Just a little. I can't remember if I've seen the Cowboy Chris Jericho debut match.
Lots of Jerry Mara.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Who were the bowlers? Was Jerry Mara one of the bowlers? No, it was Duke Myers and. Was it Jerry Mara?
I can't remember.
Do you know about this? That one of their top heel tag teams was the Bowlers.
Yeah,
it was Duke Myers and someone as wearing bowling team jerseys, and
it was not Stampede Wrestling, folks. Let's put it that way.
No, I mean they had the veterans. They had the local veteran crew,
Beef Wellington, and
guys like that, and then some of the the younger trainee guys coming in like Jericho and Storm. But there wasn't a lot going on there, and there was also something in a Calgary Sun article that was in Global Wrestling News Service. I didn't put this in the notes because it was a little, I don't know if nebulous would be the right word. That they were also working with a promotion in Winnipeg, and that they were going to try to form some kind of like national thing, which I guess would be Tony Condello's promotion.
Yes.
And I don't know if anything happened with that, but I do believe that, I don't know if it's concurrently or then when CNWA kind of vanishes, cause that I do believe that Tony Condello got the TSN time slot at some point during all this, didn't he?
Yes.
So was that after CNWA, I guess?
I'm guessing, yes.
Which, yeah, I mean, that it's kind of a big deal, I guess, that, especially when you think about the history of it, the TSN wrestling started as the AWA Winnipeg show.
Yep.
And then briefly was a WWF show, and then Stampede gets it for a few years, and thank God for that, because they showed more complete versions of the matches than
I know it. God knows.
Albeit on a 3-month delay.
Well, still.
Yeah.
Nothing.
But yeah, and then Stu shuts down, and Fred May figures, you know, he still has all these time slots, so he...
Kind of like Ron West, wasn't it?
Funny how that works.
Yeah.
And of course, he was working with Frank Sassone, who was the owner of the Silver Dollar Action Center, who is one of Stu's good buddies.
Yeah. Now, moving on to Puerto Rico for WWC, which is always a treat when we get to them. On February 3rd in Bayamón, former WBC Super Featherweight Champion Alfredo Escalera was the special referee for a Universal Heavyweight title match between Leo Burke and TNT, the great Savio Vega, which saw Chiqui Star interfere to get Burke DQ'd to retain his title. And then Escalera knocked Chiqui out. Now, the next night in Aguadilla, Los Mercenarios, Cuban Assassin, which is Angel Acevedo, not David Sierra, and Ron Starr defeated the Renegade Warriors, Chris and Mark Youngblood, for the WWC World Tag titles. Now, Tim, I always love it when the boxers are special referees.
Oh, yeah.
This led to a match. The next week, those two worked each other, and, of course, Escalera knocked out Chiqui Star again.
Oh, God. I love when boxers get involved. I mean, it's back in this, you know, these days when boxing was one of the best, you know, best regarded sports in the world. The wrestling companies would go out and try and get these guys, and it's really cool to hear stories about this where, you know, get the boxers involved. Some don't work out as well as we thought they would, as Nobuhiko Takada would show us a couple years later with Trevor Burbick.
Trevor Burbick's fault.
But that's what I'm saying is, like, some people know how to use this. Like, WWC obviously, you know, get Chiqui Star in there, aggravate him.
Wait a second. Takada knew how to use him. He just did it in an unconventional way. He just shot on him and made him look like a pussy when he left. And he walked out.
One of the few guys that Takada could beat.
Right, exactly.
Well, the whole thing was, even under the worked rules, low kicks were supposed to be illegal. And then Takada starts shoot low kicking him, and Burbick's looking at the referee, and he's like, no, keep going. And then Burbick just decides, you know, screw this, and walks out on the mat. God bless Takada.
God bless Takada. I like this stuff too. And I think when it's done on the main stage, like the Floyd Mayweather stuff was obviously great.
Was that Floyd Mayweather worked with, Tim?
The Big Show.
And God. What?
Oh, and by the way, if you haven't read it yet, there's a great article on the the Big Show was a boxer and they played into that and. What a time that was when Floyd Mayweather came in to work Big Show in 2008. Just
now,
crazy.
I thought you were actually going to
plug the article.
No. But I thought that was implied. I thought that was actually. You should go read the article that was written about the Big Show and his boxing career that didn't get off to the way that I think the Big Show thought it was going to. And some of the stories behind that, because you did a good job on that. So nicely done.
I want to talk about Escalera real quick. Escalera was a legend in Puerto Rico. Like I said, former world champion. And in fact, his nickname was El Salsero, the Salsa King. And he had a famous match that I think is on YouTube. I hope it is, because I've seen it on video before, but on tape. He fought Alexis Arguello, the legendary Nicaraguan boxer, in Bayamón, on January 28th, 1978. And in there this fight, he suffered a broke nose, broken teeth, a cut on his tongue above his left eye, and a closed right eye before submitting to Arguello. And the bout was dubbed, quote, the Bloody Battle of Bayamon, unquote. Love that name.
How was that never a name of a WWC home video release, Bloody Battles of Bayamon?
I know. I mean, that is an awesome name. But yeah, that it's just a local guy, a local legend that, you know, was using the right role. So,
was there you go. Was that the first or the second time they faced each other?
That would be the first time.
Okay, because it is on YouTube. I found it on YouTube.
And they fought again in 79 in Rimini.
Okay.
Which is a like an island off in Italy. And yeah. Arguello knocked him out in the 13th round there.
Nice.
So.
Oh, yeah, that's because it's late 70s, so we still got 15
and another
rounds.
Thing that. And another thing, when he retired, when Escalera retired in 1980, he became a wrestler. But I think he, if I'm not mistaken, he worked in opposition of WWC. So
Paging Bariqua.
Yeah, and then he eventually made a comeback in boxing, fighting, you know, a few guys here and there. And, of course, he would retire again. But, yeah, Escalera was a pretty damn good action fighter. No shock.
I'm actually going to link to this in our Skype chat just so you guys can see it too if you guys want to put that up. But there's the fight right there.
Okay. Yeah, there it is. There yeah. it is. I so. Think it was on Wild World of Sports or one of those shows.
It was. This was one of Howard Cosell's like waning days with Wild World of Sports. This was one of the last ones he did, if I remember right.
Because at this time period, boxing was on all three networks.
Yes.
You know, NBC Sports World, CBS Sports Saturday, and Wild World of Sports. So,
right.
And we're not done talking about boxing yet this week.
No, we'll be talking about boxing more in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to get a little potpourri in as Dave Meltzer started this week as a regular columnist for The National, which was a daily sports newspaper and a wrestling in a wrestling column that will run weekly on Monday. Now, we talked about The National last week. Dave said it was hard to say what direction the column would take right now, as they're playing it by ear to see the response, but said that it wouldn't be as revealing as The Observer, although he wouldn't ignore the significant news stories either. Dave said that there wouldn't be any headlines such as, quote, this is all fake, unquote, but he wasn't going to pretend wrestling is something that it isn't either. After all, if Titan Sports testifies that wrestling is all fake, and that the wrestlers do everything they could to avoid hurting each other, it's going to be impossible to even try to report that story without revealing a lot. In Matt Watch, Steve Beverly wrote that, quote, Titan Sports, in their, usual misguided attempt to control the media, has applied pressure to kill the column, unquote. Now, me and Big talked about this last week a little bit, Tim, but...
Well, and also...
The National...
got to jump in for a second, though. Also, seeing that is interesting, because as we talked about last week... It was a buddy of the WWF that recommended Dave for the column in the first place.
Exactly.
It was Dick Ebersol.
Yeah. But the National, you know, had a short run, but it had a, you know, like I said last week, a murderous row of columnists and did really good until, you know, the business of daily newspapers caught up with them.
Right. Yeah. In fact, going back to the Ebersol story, wasn't it true that Meltzer had newsletters being sent to someone high up in the NBC offices? Wasn't that kind of one of the – like when people were asking who subscribed to the newsletters, wasn't it kind of assumed that Ebersol or someone else high up were getting them? I think I remember hearing that story. But
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I thought I remember hearing that too. But the National is still to this day regarded as like the great lost sports newspaper. And Grantland, when it opened in 2010, one of their first articles they did was on the National. It was an oral history of the National. And they mentioned Meltzer in it, but they said that they covered everything, every beat they could, and pro wrestling was one of the things they covered. And when Meltzer – I can't remember whose show he was on. It might have been Austin's, but it might have been someone else's show. But the National, I think he brought it up or someone else brought it up. And it was an interesting kind of blurb in this time frame for Dave because I don't know how much he was getting paid for it, but I think he saw it as a way to, you know, he'd worked at newspapers before, if I remember right, and mm-hmm. you know, he loved the sports journalism aspect. He loved the idea of writing about, you know, sports on a regular basis, and this seemed like his break. He seemed like this would be his quote unquote way to go legit, the non-newsletter route. But it didn't end up working out, and you know, that'll come in the next couple of weeks, you know, or the next couple of months when you guys go through it. But this was kind of an interesting kind of left turn, so to speak, at Albuquerque for the newsletter business at the time, because you're talking about a guy who had been doing the newsletters as long as he has, and now getting an actual opportunity to work for an accredited daily newspaper. And that, if it stayed around and Meltzer stayed writing for the National for a bit, it could have changed the face of journalism and professional wrestling, and really could have taken a different direction than it ended up going when it didn't work out between the two.
And that said, the National exposure is what led to the Observer being a viable business for Dave.
Which is the funny part about it, because he ended up getting what he wanted in some way, is that he got like you said, a national audience. So it's interesting, you know, and it sucks, because it is the story of the National is still talked about. Like, you know, there are people growing up, you know, a little bit older than me, who saw it when the Sporting News was still a big deal, and of course Sports Illustrated was the, you know, the tome of all sports writing at this point. But to have an actual newspaper on the daily spout sports, you know, in a newspaper, was like a dream come true at this point.
Yeah, I used to buy it. As an 11-year-old, I used to buy it.
And so it was pretty neat to see that happening. And like Vic said, it's like this actually was the platform that jumped off the Wrestling Observer Newsletter as a national brand, as the first widely circulated national wrestling newsletter.
And have either, like, I guess Chris, and I guess to an extent Tim, you read it at the time, but have you seen them anywhere since? Because, like, I have one of Dave's columns that years ago, like, Kurt Brown sent me a package that had a bunch of stuff, old newsletters and stuff, and in there was a Xeroxed copy of an article Dave did about Medusa's success in Japan, which I did scan and I do have on my computer. But, like, have you seen any of this stuff, like, around ever?
No. I mean, I saw it in newsstands growing up.
Right.
I mean, but I never – I was like 5 or 6 at the time, so I wasn't out there buying newspapers. But, like, since, I haven't really even thought to look for them, to be honest with you. But and even with the Grantland story coming out, I didn't really have an onus on looking for old Nationals. And
they're
and
on stuff eBay. Like that.
They are on eBay, though. So
yeah, for cheap, too. Yeah.
So
I guess we'd have to find out if we wanted to get those – like, what day of the week was Dave's –
Huh. Yeah,
Monday.
It was Monday.
Supposedly, yeah.
Ooh,
so,
okay.
So I think we so might I'm looking have. To...
at, yeah, $9.99, $4.99, $2.99, $6. That's the last issue here. $6. $2.99, $5.99 for 2 copies. $2.99. All cheap.
Hmm.
Dang.
So there you go. There you go, Bex. There's your project.
There you go.
I don't know if I'm paying them. Well, we'll have to all talk together about that, because I'm not buying that just for Dave's columns. I'm not paying $10 just to get one Dave column.
Well, it didn't run for too long, so you wouldn't, and Dave wasn't with the paper long either, and so you probably wouldn't have to buy too many.
Well, when did they close though?
June 1991.
Yeah, so they were only around for basically a year, 15 months. That's basically how long they were around.
And he was there for at least a year.
Yeah, because we talked about him last week in January 1991. You know, and that stuff was going on. All right, June 13th is the final edition. So there you go. All right, moving on. Roller Games has been canceled.
Speaking of Dave Meltzer.
Right. And both Titan and Turner are vying for the time slots on the 130 U.S. TV station that carried the show. The last show will air on March 3rd and 4th, and Titan already had success getting 4 stations, sending out a fax saying, quote, "You bought Roller Games because you were told it was WWF in the 90s. Well, why not take the real thing?" Unquote. Turner would love to get the slots as well to air their NWA Pro show in markets that don't already carry it. Now, Bix, I don't know how many of these stations end up going to wrestling, but I like the NWA strategy, you know, to try to expose that pro show more instead of trying to stick, you know, their number one show worldwide out there.
So is that what it's saying? Because I read it more as that they were trying to prioritize pro more as the syndicated show they were getting out there, because it does, because in my head I'm also thinking, well, they did make pro the show in New York and Chicago.
Yes.
So I don't know. You know,
but worldwide, hierarchy does.
No, I agree, but you understand how I read that, though.
Yeah, I can see where you would get that. Yes.
As far as, let's see, so Roller Games, like, did both of you watch Roller Games? Because I know I watch Roller Games every
day. I watched it a little bit. I watched Roller Derby when it was on ESPN, you know, when it had the AWA stuff with AWA.
Slam and I tried.
Yeah, I tried watching Roller Games, and it wasn't the same to me. I mean, I was a big, the Bombers.
The San Francisco Bay Bombers?
Yeah, I was a Bombers fan, I think it was. Or whoever, what was the team that Ralphie Valadares played for?
San Francisco Bay Bombers.
There you go. I was a Ralphie Valadares fan. I thought he was cool as hell. No, he was the Los Angeles Thunderbirds.
Oh, okay.
There you go. Yeah, the Los Angeles Thunderbirds.
Now, right, okay, so that is Roller Games then. That's not Roller Derby. It might not be this version of Roller Games.
No, he returned.
But,
yeah, he returned.
Okay.
For that show, yeah.
And now I'm guessing, though, what probably happened is that American Gladiators, when they retooled, took advantage of this.
Yes.
Because the season started in fall, the first season started in fall 89, right?
Yes.
And American Gladiators retooled for the second half of the season.
Yeah.
So I'm going to guess that they tried to take over slots.
Holy shit. I'm reading about Roller Games.
Okay.
I didn't know Wally George did halftime commentary.
Oh, I remember that.
And get this, Chet Forty was a director, and Chet Forty is like sports, you know, royalty. He was the Monday Night Football director for many, many, many years. Yeah, they brought him in to direct the show.
And also, this, of course, is the show that had the alligator pit.
Yeah. I was going to say, it was too silly for me.
And the T-Bird twins. Are you kidding? That was awesome.
Well, it was too silly for me at the time.
And the T-Bird twins got split up, and they had to each go to one of the heel teams.
Yeah.
With Miss Georgia Haas as the abusive implied lesbian. Well, as we found out recently, actual lesbian heel manager.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. It's time for Roll Again. Oh
wow.
Yeah, I do remember this song.
Even get to the chorus. Wow.
And so they used to air it late at night. In fact, in most markets, it went up against Saturday Night Live.
Here, it was Saturday mornings, I think, on a different station from WWF, though.
Yeah, if I remember right. See, on Saturday nights in Atlanta, at this time period, was Superstars of Wrestling.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you watched. I would catch Saturday Night Live. I would usually tape it and watch it, you know, the next day. But, yeah, Superstars of Wrestling was the way to go in Atlanta. I mean, if you're a wrestling fan in Atlanta, you ain't watching nothing else.
Actually, so. I think it was on either before, but I think it was after the WCW show on PIX.
Well, there you go.
So, yeah. And did you either of you ever play either of the Roller Games video games?
No.
So there are two. There's an NES game, which I think is just like a side-scrolling game, and there isn't very good. And there's an arcade game, which you can play in emulators and stuff on computers, which is an actual roller derby game. You are playing roller games.
I'm going to have to check that out. I have a mod box, and I got to see if that's part of my lineup here. What's it called again?
It's just called Roller Games. So if you have a MAME set,
Okay.
Then it should be in there.
I will have to check this out.
It's not bad. It's one of those. I'm a sucker for arcade games from that era.
Yeah.
That did not come out like for consoles or anything.
Right.
And that's one of them. I think it was maybe Konami that put it out, and they put out a lot of stuff like that that didn't come out for consoles. So it's interesting. It's better than you'd expect. Going around a track in circles to be, because you know you're hitting people, and it's not bad. It's honestly not bad. It's better than the theme song is. Call it.
Now, speaking of syndicated television, TV syndicator Tor Berg has told sources close to Matt Watch that he does not have the rights to the February 10th Tokyo Dome show as originally reported, but a 2-hour condensed version that he wants to pitch to local stations. Now, it's funny we hear this stuff, you know, to this day about Tokyo Dome shows on American television. This probably was the first time that this, well, of course it had been the first time because Tokyo Dome shows were just a year old.
Right.
But this is the first time that this type of thing happened.
Yeah, it's kind of weird to think of how you would pitch this show. I'm trying
in
to
1990.
Think of, in 1990. Trying to think how you would pitch this show with a show with nobody that American audiences would really be too aware of.
Larry Zbysko is about the only name because Flair pulled out.
Saito. So, but Saito drawn. Yeah, I don't know. I think it would have been interesting to see if it made TV at the time. I don't think it would have been really, really, really well received. I think you would have really had to have, like, once the New Japan WCW partnership started up again in 91 and that, you know, lasted into 92, you know, that ended up being something where if they pitched it, it would have been a better situation, obviously, because you could have pitched it as part of WCW programming. I just think it's odd that just out of nowhere, it's like, oh, hey, you know, I got this 2-hour Japanese wrestling show that I think would be really cool to put on your syndicated TV. And, like, I don't know. It's kind of weird.
I was a little disappointed that Chris didn't emphasize the name Tor Berg this time.
Yeah, I was about to talk about Tor Berg, Bits, because this is one of your favorite people.
I just love the name.
Yeah, tell everyone again what Tor Berg ended up doing.
He was the LPWA guy.
Exactly.
Now,
exactly.
One thing I'm wondering reading this, the Superpowers Clash videotape, the commercial videotape of the previous year's Dome Show, was that a Tor Berg production?
It could have been.
Well,
I don't know for sure.
Well, you know what the big connection I'm thinking of in my eyes is Ken Resnick being the announcer.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense.
So I would
put two and two together. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember, was Bachwinkle, because Bachwinkle was the color guy. Was Bachwinkle involved with the LPWA?
I don't remember. I remember Cornette
and Slaughter.
Yeah,
Brad
Rangins. Yeah, I remember Bachwinkle and LPWA. He could have made an appearance or two there.
But I would think. Well, I guess Tor Berg was a Minnesota guy.
Yeah. Well, he's got that Viking name.
So yeah, I would think he was involved with that, and that had that whole, you know, USA versus Japan versus Russia angle. So I don't know, but I wonder if there's some confusion here. Like, I wonder if the videotape hadn't come out yet, and maybe there's some confusion. They're actually talking about the previous year's show.
Well, I mean, that's what Steve Beverly was talking about. So who knows? It could have been the year before show. So who knows? Anyway, moving on. Former NWA World Heavyweight Champion Wimber Billy Watson, who was arguably the most popular of all the native Canadian wrestlers, passed away on February the 4th at the age of 74. WWF held a tribute for Watson at their Maple Leaf Gardens show that day, which some people believe was brought about after failing to acknowledge the death of Lord Athol Layton years ago when they were in Toronto. Now, Bix, we know that WWF has a, you know, shaky history regarding acknowledging deaths of wrestlers, but yeah, I mean, with Watson's legendary status in that city and the fact that people knew he died that day, that kind of had to happen, no matter what.
And it's the Tunneys. It's not.
Yeah.
It's Jack Tunney. It's not necessarily the WWF that's doing this.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, that's. When was it that Layton died?
Lord Athol Layton, I think it was 87. I'm checking just to make sure.
No, I have nothing against him, but he's not
the level of star icon in Canada that Watson was. Watson, you had to acknowledge, especially in Toronto.
Well, Leighton was the announcer, 84. So that would have been WWF. That's weird, because 84 would have been Tunney Proper.
When
would have been NWA. January.
Oh. Hmm.
That's odd. I mean, this came from the Observer, that line. So, well, I don't know. Dave must have got confused with his timeline there, but I mean, whatever. But Watson's name just came up recently, Tim, with the whole Bret Hart deal, you know, when Bret Hart revealed his prostate cancer. And it was like, you know, in the Observer, it was noted that Bret Hart had taken over Whipper Billy Watson's spot as the most popular of all the native wrestlers in Canada.
Huh. There you go. I haven't followed too much Canadian wrestling history. I really only know too much about, you know, Stampede and whether Dave Musgrave talks about Leo Burke and you know, but yeah, I mean, Billy Watson, yeah, I hadn't really heard too much about him before I saw this. So
had a shitty wrestling son, I know that. Beat Luthes for the title. Luthes thought highly of him.
Of Greg Watson?
No, Whipper.
Okay, you Whipper leave Billy. A lot of space there before moving to next.
Yeah, Greg Watson went beating Luthes. And I mean, yeah, just a guy, just a big name, you know, in Canada. So,
man.
But yeah, like I said, WWF, WWE, shaky history to this day regarding deaths of wrestlers. Anyway, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. Let the place to be, boys, pay the bills. When we come back, we go back to America and talk about some ICW. Yep, the Saboldis made their appearance on this show. We'll be right back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place for Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
And we're back, and we'd like to thank everyone for listening to this show, as well as the rest of the show on the Place to Be Nation Network. And if you want to support this show in particular, you know, you don't have to give any money to help us out, but whenever you do purchase from Amazon.com, and if you're like me, I purchase numerous times a week. In fact, I made a purchase this last Tuesday, and I went through our referral page, which is tinyurl.com/BTS Amazon. So you type that in, do your shopping on Amazon. We get a little percentage of the sale, and it helps us out to get our proper research we need for this show. If we talk about the national newspapers, hell, if you know, we get a nice little, you know, bit of money from you guys, we can buy these national newspapers and go through them and see what we can get for use on these shows. So
yes,
help us out any way you can. Like I said, we're not asking for money. We're just asking, you know, for when you buy stuff off Amazon to help us out.
And you don't pay anything extra.
It's don't pay anything extra.
As if you're buying anything else from Amazon, except we get a percentage because Amazon is just that philanthropic.
Or yeah, if you'd like to donate the actual national magazine to the show.
I'll let you do that, Tim. You're the guest. Hey. You can beg. But no, we're not going Aubrey Citizen here. We're you know, begging for donations.
I wasn't going to have to hear that name on this podcast. But there we are.
So, yeah, we're not doing that. We just, you know, when you use Amazon, think of us. All right. ICW, as we mentioned going to the break, we don't get to talk about them much because, quite frankly, they didn't do a whole lot, but air Tony Atlas and Vic Steamboat matches for every week on television. But now we have some major problems here. It's beset by several major disputes. Promoters Angelo and Mario Savoldi were on the verge of losing key ICW wrestlers last week, but insiders believe the dispute will be settled. Mario Savoldi fired ICW announcer Bob Dow, and a New York-based production company is threatening not to take future ICW shows, claiming they are owed $100,000 in production fees. A key source told Matt Walsh that all the talent, quote, want out, unquote, especially after a TV taping was canceled on February 11th in Long Island. Now, Bix, this is your territory.
Okay,
ICW aired a lot in your area. I saw very little of it, but Bob Dow, that's the first time we mentioned his name on this show. Talk about Bob Dow.
Bob Dow was not very good. The thing that sticks in my mind, I mean, is when they had the ICW tag team title tournament, which consisted of airing matches that had nothing to do with it, but claiming it was part of this international tournament, they'd air matches from Wynn.
Like, yes. The Red Bastien group.
Yes. And they'd have it was like, I guess maybe Chavo and Mondo or Chavo and Eddie Guerrero. And he would just keep mispronouncing Guerrero and stuff like that. As Tony Rumble would keep correcting him. And, I looked up ICW Bob Dow on YouTube, and God bless the internet, because the first thing I see, someone has uploaded the pool party episode of ICW, or at least the pool party segments, to YouTube. So if you've never heard Bob Dow before, let's give your ears a treat for a moment.
Oh boy. See, my normal partner, Tony Rumble, with me is Victor Steamboat. And in the pool,
what a shot!
Having a looks like a good time, Victor. You see the Surf Kid? That's of course Ray of Odyssey.
Ray Odyssey.
And also the Miami Kid Eric Sprecher. We get a little wet.
The Miami Kid Eric Sprecher. What?
Victor, again,
I don't remember that being his nickname.
Shows, and it's always kind of nice to relax and to get to show a show like this at poolside and without the Boston bad boy. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. It's very relaxing. It keeps your mind off a few
things. I'll tell you, Tony, again, one of the things, Jose, that obviously when you're working with Tony Rumble, you just have to put up with a lot.
That's
right.
That's
what we'll have to do.
He's got
to
behave. He's got to take care of himself when he's run.
Jesus, this sounds like a TV show produced by me.
And here I was before the show extolling the virtues of Bix's podcast production.
But seriously, he's stammering like he's me calling a wrestling match.
Oh, man. I mean, the little ICW I saw, it was bad television.
But it was tremendous.
Lots of like a Ray Odyssey, Eric Sprasha, Steamboat, Vic Steamboat. Not Rick. Vic Steamboat, Tony Atlas, Tony Rumble.
Jumpin' Joe Savoldi.
The Undertakers. I remember them being on Big Valpuccio. Oh, terrible stuff. Although I will say this, Paul Lee was there at this time period, and Tim, Paul Lee managed a tag team, the Lethal Weapons, Doug Gilbert, and Loverboy Dennis Condrey.
Man, that's
that
awesome.
That was a badass team.
That's a badass team right there.
But Bob Dow was the announcer, and he sucked then too. So.
Oh, God.
Oh, wait a second. Here's part two, and now he's joined by Surfer Ray Odyssey.
Oh, Jesus.
I've got a very special hour for you this hour. And as you can see, we're not in our normal habitat, and I'm not with my normal sidekick, Tony Rumble. We are just outside of Los Angeles, California. We're on a three-day layover here with the ICW. And
what?
Yes. They were in Long Beach, New York.
And the Miami Eric Gracia, and with me, Ray Odyssey. And Ray, some big news for you as we enjoy this three-day layover. Round Robin coming up in July. You, the number one contender for the light heavyweight championship, along with El Diablo from Mexico. And the
El Diablo.
El Diablo.
Also, go look this up on YouTube and ask yourself how $100,000 was spent on this. And how long it would have taken to spend said $100,000.
I didn't have to look. When I saw $100,000, I was like, how does that work?
Alberta, and round robin coming up, as we said, the first to win two is guaranteed a shot at the five-time light heavyweight champion of the world, the amazing blazing Robbie Ellis.
That's right,
Robbie Ellis.
You know, he's the new and improved Robbie Ellis now.
New and improved. He was old then.
In a couple months, but from what I hear, he's been here and there and defending his title, and we're just going to have him come back here and put it up against like the winner of this round robin. I guess from what you say now, Bob, it's the Edge from out there somewhere in
Calgary.
Calgary. And then from so what you got is El Diablo down south,
Mexico.
So you got Canada, you got Mexico,
horrible,
and you got the good old
it's like
US
a Portland
today.
Promo
and
from the late 80s
this is going to get a
with
shot
Don Cos trying to lead
and Robin Ellis.
Also, is it me or does Odyssey's
we'll
voice remind you of Rob Naylor?
Now let's take a look.
At oh, yeah, so there's a similarity there.
Against the Mad Russian just a few weeks ago.
Well, have you ever, Mr. Rubble?
I think this might actually be during this period, too, because, as you notice, they're airing rerun matches. I wonder why.
I wonder why.
Besides that they're ICW, and that's what they do.
Yeah. Moving on to another territory in the Pacific Northwest.
You're being generous to ICW by calling them a territory.
Yeah, no. On February 3rd in Portland, another Portland. It was Portland, Maine. We go to Portland, Oregon, where Curtis Thompson won the Northwest Heavyweight title from Scotty the Body. And, yes, U.S. male Curtis Thompson. Rip Oliver, the Crippler, brought out his 17-year-old son, Larry, for an interview on the show when the Grappler attacked both of them while Jonathan Holliday and Al Madrill held Larry as Grappler yelled insults saying that Rip really wasn't his father. Dave said that the angle became hilarious once 78-year-old Don Owen came out and tried to pull Grappler off of Oliver.
Oh, God.
Tim, I've been watching a lot of Portland lately, getting ready for the Portland version of the 80s project on Pro Wrestling Only, Death of the Driver. Don Owen is so hilarious for intentionally, unintentionally. I mean, he's everybody loved Don Owen as a promoter because of how he paid and stuff like that. And he's a gem of a man. We need more old guys in wrestling like Don Owen.
Yeah, I mean, and he did commentary too on a lot of that stuff in the 80s, if I remember right. I think I remember some
in the early period.
Yeah, like because I remember watching a Martel Buddy Rose match, I think from 80 or 81, where he was on commentary.
Yeah, him and Frank Bonomo did the commentary. Yeah,
right. That's like 68-year-old Don Owen on commentary, which is just the freaking best.
Was why am I forgetting? Was that right when Frank Bonomo died?
No, Obama died later. But Don was—I mean, different people would always come in with the play-by-play man, and Don was one of those guys at the time period that would do it. Don's son did it with Don Cos later on. Barry would commentate with.
Did Elton ever do commentary? That would have been interesting.
No, Art Barr did. I watched Art Barr announcing with Don Cos before he became Beetlejuice. But yeah, Don Owen, between Tom Peterson and Don Owen, I mean, Tom Peterson was the main sponsor of Portland shows, and he would sometimes show up to promote his goods. He had an electronics store. He'd be sitting in this recliner chair pimping the high-tech VCRs of the era and stuff like that while having this great flat top. And Don Owen there, and Don, I mean, Don Owen is just hilarious. I love Don Owen. But Biggs, we got to talk about the U.S. Mail, Curtis Thompson.
We do.
We talked about him before. This was probably his biggest push in the territory. Because yeah, he was a Northwest champion. He was a Northwest tag champion. I mean, Don really loved those green guys. I mean, God knows I've seen a lot of it lately. But, yeah, Curtis Thompson, he had the look, but he just sucked so bad. He couldn't make it in a big stage.
Stampede closes down. The two guys you bring in are Curtis Thompson and Jonathan Holiday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's probably all Don really. I mean, he was one of those young guys, I guess.
You couldn't bring in. There are a lot of people. I mean, there are. Larry Cameron, the Blackhearts.
Yeah.
And Juan Wellington.
And real quick before we move on, talk about Scotty the Body. I mean, Scott, people know about, you know, Scott Anthony and Raven and Scotty Flamingo and Johnny Polo. But Scotty the Body in Portland was the beginning of that whole deal. And he was really, really good. I mean, I watched his debut show the other day, and he was just outstanding on that. First time in as a heel, really.
Well, he hadn't been wrestling long anyway.
No, he only been wrestling for like a year when he debuted in Portland.
Yeah, and I guess his biggest exposure before that was the Memphis angle.
Yeah, as a babyface.
Well, who turns heel.
Yeah.
Where he turns heel to help Eddie Gilbert beat Jerry Lawler because he was promised a date with Missy High.
Which in 1988, you know, come on, definitely.
I don't know, but it's also 1988 Scott leaving. He was a very handsome young man.
Yeah, well, Missy was a little good-looking woman.
Saying, no, I'm just saying that they're playing him. It's kind of interesting that they're playing him as this meek guy who's unsure of himself, especially when, in your words, he had a...
Yes, he was packing down there.
I was giving you the opening to say the word horse cock.
Yeah, horse cock. Yeah, he was gifted, no doubt. I really didn't want to talk about cock on this show, but you got in there. Somehow it always happens that way. Okay. Well, anyway, you went to Memphis. Let's go to Memphis, and this is one of my favorite sections of the show.
And
maybe my favorite
segment. And well, in this segment too, and that I thought this used to be on YouTube, but it's not.
Jerry the King Lawler, who has been reborn this year since moving the SmackDown with Mauro Ranallo, showed up on WMC TV show on February 3rd wearing a doctor's uniform. I guess he's not like Dr. Death. Claiming to be Dr. Lawler. And he said that he had two urine specimens, with one of them Jeff Jarrett and the other one of Kerry Von Erich. And that he was going to test both for steroids.
Oh my God.
He said that the instrument he had beat, then the wrestler was using steroids. And of course, both beat, with Lawler then going on a tantrum about steroids, saying that everyone in the business has forgotten about wrestling, and all they care about is muscles, so they're juicing up. Lawler said that Jarrett would weigh 110 pounds without roids, and said that roids mess with your brain, saying that Kerry Von Erich is definite proof of that. Just listen to him talk.
Lawler
then talked about how the business is losing wrestlers, and instead has steroid freaks, mentioning Hulk Hogan, Sting, and the Road Warriors by name, which Dave said that Lawler's heel interviews are amazing because everything he says are true.
Oh, God damn. Oh, but, man.
Tim, yeah, the heel Jerry Lawler.
Oh, God.
At the end of 89 into 90 until like April, May, in that area, spring 90, was like some of the best Jerry Lawler ever. I mean, you talk about some promo work.
Yeah,
this guy was just on fire.
Yeah, no, he's this is the 1990 USWA stuff that came out around this time that Lawler's a part of. Just incredible. He totally just kind of swooped in and kind of, you know, just got this exposure and decided to, you know, do all that great stuff. And I hadn't even heard of this promo yet, but holy shit. I mean, that's like King Lawler promo, not like, you know, pun included. I mean, that's like the best type of promo that Lawler could cut at the time, just because of the wrestling, you know, the atmosphere in wrestling was, you know, with the steroids and WWF and all that, and, you know, and Luger and Sting and all. It's like, I mean, Jesus criminy. Fuck. So did you say that this was on YouTube, or is this not on YouTube anymore?
I thought it used to be, but I was looking. I can't find it.
Damn. Oh, boy.
I might need to put it up there because I think it's on the on the yearbooks, and I know I have the yearbooks. So.
Yeah, Lawler is just – he was shooting left and right.
Although, that's the best part about it was that, you know – In Memphis, you know, Lawler being Lawler, it's like anything he says is gospel. And so it just makes him, when he's a face, loved more, or when he's a heel, hate him more. And like, I mean, Jesus Christ, that type of stuff is the best. It really is. He is like the king of crossing that line. And we all saw it with Kaufman. I mean, that was brilliant. And you know, some of the stuff he did, I mean, throughout the years, like still working with – in the last 5-10 years, working great angles with non-wrestlers and all this stuff and really making it work in Memphis after, you know, his heyday 20 years ago. It's like, it's insane. Just his acumen for using stuff that, you know, people would perceive as real or unreal one way or the other, but there's some basis to it. There is some, you know, there is some truth to what he's saying, and just, that's incredible. Just a fucking incredible story.
Well, and a few months after this, you got the Snowman.
Right. Which is one of the greatest, that's an incredible angle. I actually just watched that a couple weeks ago because Steven and I were talking about that. And it's insane. That whole 6-week period is just the most insane thing ever.
The thing is, Biggs, about this, though, is Jerry Jarrett is still the boss.
Right,
and Lawler's just teeing off on Jeff Jarrett being a roided up guy.
Well, Chris, he's a heel. Heels lie.
I know, but
also interesting how Dave said that everything Lawler says on his interviews are true.
Well, Dave was anti-steroids at this time period.
Oh, really?
Really?
I love with this segment too how sometimes Lawler with his favorite lines from like the joke book or whatever, they're too clunky, but this is one of his best uses of it because it's a line that he's used at other times in a more clumsy way, but here he's doing his special test, and I don't know if one of the girls in the audience says something or whatever, but he says something like, but he says, "Don't get excited, it's not a taste test."
Oh my God. Are you serious? Yes. Oh my God, Lawler. Oh, he's a god. He's a fucking wow.
Also, this segment also has one of the very best Dave Brown performances, I think.
Speaking of Dave Brown, he got name dropped on W Television this week. For those that haven't seen it, Lawler on the main, I think it was main event. Yeah, main event, supposedly, with Rich Brennan. Started going off about how he's in Memphis, Tennessee, and he was stuck with no talent by Rich Brennan, and how he said that he wished that Lance Russell and Dave Brown were here on WWE television in 2016.
Well, that's the main event. Who's gonna?
Yeah,
no one's watching.
But Lawler has definitely been reborn this year with Mauro. That's a great thing that's happened on WWE television.
Yeah.
So, anyway, moving on. Also in this TV show, the Southern Rockers made their debut. This is Steve Dahl and Rex King, not Steve Dahl and Scott Peterson. And they beat Robert Fuller and Brian Lee, for BTS favorite Brian Lee, for the USWA tag titles.
That's not who I thought you were going to call a BTS favorite.
Well, BTS Hall of Famer Robert Fuller. And Fuller then put up $1,000 for a rematch and lost again. Then he put $2,000 for another rematch. And this time, Fuller and Lee regained their belts. So they wrestled 3 times on television.
Right.
But, Robert Fuller, you know, of course, known for his endowment.
Great booking ability.
Booking ability. He was a booker here, though, but, that was a joke. If you know, I don't know if you saw it on Twitter the other day that, I think it was me and, MLJ was talking about, booking Robert Fuller and Too Cold Scorpio in the Ultimate X match.
That's so terrible.
No, I know where I said I know where the X would be hanging from.
Oh my God.
But I remember seeing this, and it was a fun angle. It was one of those only in Memphis type deals on live television that you could do something like this. You know, and the Rockers got 2 wins. lost the third match. And then they eventually won the belts back at a house show in Louisville. So not that long after. So,
wait, they did a title change that they didn't do in every town?
Yeah. One of the rare opportunities. Yeah, one of the rare times they did that.
Hmm.
Now, Tim Livingston's favorite scuzzy wrestler, John Tatum, made his return at TV taping at Sportatorium on February 3rd. That's right. The same day as Live Memphis, because they had to tape live in both places, with eight girls by his side. Tatum is in an interesting situation since he also works for Killer Tim Brooks's group as well. Now, Mark Lawrence missed the taping because he was doing TCU basketball, and Percy Pringle handled the play-by-play. But Gary Von Erich didn't know that, as he called Percy Mark five times, with Percy telling him at least four of those times that he wasn't Mark. Well, those steroids, you know.
Yes, the steroids. God.
But hey. This was Kerry Von Erich's birthday. That's one thing I forget, failed to mention here. And Bix, on this promo, one of the promos he did with Percy, I know for sure, he was joking about his birthday, and he said that he was turning 19 years old. And he was trying to play that as a joke, but Percy was no-selling him, because Percy, I guess, was pissed off because he kept calling him Mark. And it said, I don't remember seeing this, but I read about it, that they just stood there with like awkward silence before Percy started asking him the next question. And of course, Kerry was turning 30 that day. That was his 30th birthday. But Bix, before I get to Tim about the John Tatum love.
Hey, guys, I'm sorry I have to interrupt here, but I have to get going for something, and I forgot that I had an appointment. So feel free to go the rest of the way without me, but it's something that I have to be there in like in 10 minutes, and it totally slipped my mind.
Jesus Christ.
I'm really sorry. I didn't even think about this. But the rest of the way, you guys can go without me. I'm sorry, but I totally, totally forgot about this, and I feel completely bad about leaving in the middle of the show like this, but...
Well, it is what it is.
Yeah, man, I'm sorry. Like, I totally didn't even think about it. I got to run down there right now.
Exactly.
So. Yeah. All right, Tim. We appreciate you being on the show, buddy.
No problem, man. Sorry I couldn't finish it off with you guys, but have fun the rest of the way.
That's what she said.
Yeah. All right, Tim. Thanks, man.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.
Are we going to keep that in? Or you
of course we are.
You're damn right we're going to keep it in, folks. This is a professional show. It's a professional show. We move on as we go through these things. But anyway, Bix.
Kerry Von
Erich. The question I was going to ask you about the Sportatorium tapings was, this was what took over for the Fort Worth show.
Right, the KTVT show.
Yeah. Instead of taping at Will Rogers, they taped on Saturday mornings now.
Yeah, and Jared had tried to do a live version that would be in syndication, but wasn't able to sell it to anyone.
Yes.
So he taped it on Saturday mornings as the Memphis show was going on, and then it aired that night on KTVT. But Kerry, I mean, I don't want to dump on the guy, but he was not well during this period.
No, he was not. In fact, it was it before this or after this when Gorky Park?
It's around this time.
Yeah, I think it may have been in January.
It's a couple weeks earlier, yeah. And also where he's talking with... you can tell, like, that he's very, like... not flirtatious with the woman from Youthquake. Who's with Gorky Park.
Yes.
But I'll just say it. Is it me, or is his demeanor, like, he's trying to imply... that he had been with her carnally?
Yes.
Okay. That's not just me.
No.
He's clearly trying to do that.
Yes.
Okay. Should we explain who Gorky Park is?
Gorky Park was a Russian rock group that had got some type of popularity in the United States. And this was during the era where they had, Russia was... going through the changes.
Glasnost.
And they had a big rock and roll deal going on where a bunch of bands went over there. Ozzy, I think Metallica, a bunch of bands went over there.
Is this around when the Billy Joel concert was, too?
later.
Joel concerts.
Billy Joel was earlier. Yeah, okay. Billy Joel was like 86, 87. So mm-hmm. this would have been 89, and, you know, stuff like that. And yeah, that was the whole big deal going on with the rock, all the rock bands going to Russia. But yeah, Gorky Park had kind of, you know, got on radio here, stuff like that. And they were just, they were in the town. Yeah, they were in town. So they're Caravan X friends.
They stand for all the same things as the Von Erichs, like drug free.
Yes.
And also yeah. there's the, around this time, there's the Kurt Von Erich hotline. Where you can which, call and ask him anything.
I can only imagine what that was. It was a way for Carrie to pick up chicks, probably. Where are you? Where do you live? Where do you want to meet me? You know.
Here are a bunch of words that rhyme with Carrie. Very, Mary, monastery.
Why don't you go say monastat? Which again?
Oh, that's terrible, and that doesn't even make any sense.
Doesn't
rhyme with Carrie.
I know, but Carrie's women needed monastat after they were doing it.
I don't think that's how that works.
I'm just saying. I'm just talking out my ass. But I'm pretty sure Carrie probably had some chicks that were, you know, he told him to come to the sportatorium or whatever, and give him a BJ or something like that after a show or whatever.
That reminds me also, the other best part of that ad is, I don't have time to talk to all the fans of the sportatorium.
Yes, he says so much to do.
So many things to do.
Yeah, this needle isn't going to insert itself.
Oh, see, you're the one who always takes it a little too far.
All right, when you talk about going too far, Don King, his whole life is about going too far because he beat a man to death, and his boxing promoting skills were what they were, and he was in talks with Vince McMahon as we go through the WWF.
Could you imagine a meeting between those two men?
Oh, Jesus. Oh, man. Great hair. So that's definitely for sure. Now, the story ran across the newswires on February 3rd that Vince was negotiating with Don about a possible Hulk Hogan versus Mike Tyson match down the road. Tyson getting involved in the upcoming Saturday Night's Main Event show in Detroit is building on speculation, naturally, and boxing media is doing their best to bury or ignore this news, but there is so much potential income at stake to where it is a definite possibility. There are an awful lot of obstacles to overcome, though, with the main one being Tyson and his people agreeing to do a work match, as well as agreeing to an open ending with no clear-cut winner. King was quoted in the story saying that the Hogan match is a possibility since after potential fights with George Foreman and Evander Holyfield, there are no big money fights left for Tyson at the moment. Dave said Tyson isn't supposed to be at WrestleMania, but there were preliminary talks that had Tyson supposedly working Randy Savage at Mania to build the Hogan match. But since Savage has a match on the books with King Sherry against Dusty Rhodes and Sapphire, that talk has subsided. The feeling on this news, though, is that Don King wants this match more than Vince because he thinks he can get $50 million for Tyson in such a match. And in fact, Steve Beverly and Matt Watch floated the theory out that Don was the one that was floating all this information out, not Vince.
But there were real talks.
Yeah, there were real talks.
And we talked about this a few weeks ago when Jordan was on.
Yes.
Hogan wanted to do a real shoot with Tyson.
Yes. And this had been the Aftermaths were playing this up in 1987. So this was something that, you know, in wrestling world, you know, was always talked about. But the problem was a week later, Mike Tyson lost to Buster Douglas by knockout at the Tokyo Dome. And the rest is history.
while drawing half a house as opposed to New Japan, who did not.
Yeah. Which is interesting. But and of course, Buster Douglas would take this spot on the main event, you know, as a referee. But didn't do anything at WrestleMania because he's Buster Douglas, not Mike Tyson. So and of course, Mike Tyson would, you know, show up in 1998. So.
Yeah, I mean,
let's just put it out there. Do you think Hogan had enough wrestling legitimate wrestling knowledge to defeat Mike Tyson in a shoot match?
No.
I think I agree. I feel like we don't know the actual extent of what he knows. I mean, it all would have been whatever shoot stuff he learned during his training with Matsuda.
Yeah, he would have took Tyson down. But there would have been so much production involved in that match. There's no way they would have had a true shoot match. I mean, that match would have been so rigged. There's no way. No way.
Or
too big.
Is it a work and Hogan pulls a Takada? Because, hey, who did Takada learn the business from?
Yeah.
And gets Tyson in his dreaded front face lock and chokes him out.
Yeah. But if Hogan was going over anyway.
Well, I thought that was going to be an inconclusive
open ending, yeah. I mean, it could have been either or, but
can you imagine? Well, I think I feel like if Hogan thought he could actually win a shoot with Mike Tyson, then he absolutely would have considered shooting on Mike Tyson in a worked match.
Yeah.
Because if his guard's down, then
yeah.
it's different. Not that I think he would win an actual shoot, but it's interesting.
Yeah, and yeah, the fact that Mike Tyson's black. We know how Hogan feels about blacks.
Well, not if they're black athletes that make $100 million, though.
Well, he was, Mike Tyson was probably worth over $100 million in this time period. So, yeah, he would have been going to date his daughter.
That changed.
Yeah. Now, speaking of Hogan, Variety Magazine reported this week that Hulk Hogan is considering retiring and going to work for Disney,
and this is an update on something from several weeks back.
Yeah, which has been rumored for months as Kevin Kiley broke the news on a local Washington, D.C. station.
And that's not Alex Riley, that's Alex Riley's dad.
Yeah, who just got in trouble recently for talking about women in sports media, or women in sports altogether, which was hilarious.
No, not recently. It was recently at the time of this, I thought.
No.
Actual recently? I didn't realize.
Yeah, Kevin Kiley got in some deep heat because he has a talk radio show in Cleveland, a sports radio station there, where he was talking about women in sports. And yeah, he was getting buried on Twitter about it.
Oh, when you brought this up, I thought it was in the context of the NFL thing we were talking about a week or two back. I didn't realize for some reason, or I forgot. I didn't realize this was a current thing.
Yeah, he has a morning show in Cleveland.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, Hogan has told fellow wrestlers and some office people many different stories, varying from that the Warrior match will be his last match, or that he is in wrestling for the long haul. The only one that knows for sure is Hogan. If Hogan is leaving, getting the title off of him and onto Warrior is the best way of keeping things going without missing a beat and creating a Hulk Hogan of the 90s, where Dave saying, doesn't the thought of Warrior and no shoes make you cringe? At the same time, though, Dave wouldn't be surprised to see a leg drop and a three count either. Steve Beverly, though, believes that this piece was planted by the WWF to make everyone think it is a mortal lock that Warrior is winning the title. So we have two straight pieces that were planted by the promoter and in the media to get over their narrative. And Bix, I firmly believe that. I think WWF was putting this out there.
Well, they would never do such a thing.
No. We need to get Steve Plantamena's thoughts on this. But
it's an interesting way to go to, because of course it's Disney. I've wondered sometimes if Vince kind of has like a fixation on Disney. Like, did Walt Disney of wrestling come from him? You know what I mean?
Well, Walt Disney was a supposed Nazi, so they both have socialist beliefs.
Okay.
That was a joke for me calling Vince McMahon a socialist from last year's one of her last year's reaction shows.
I don't even remember.
Yeah.
It's an interesting way to go with this regardless. I mean, whatever your planted story. And do we know, did Disney ever have any kind of actual interest in him?
all we know is the innuendo that we've talked about in this show.
I guess.
I think this is them playing off the rumors themselves.
Yes.
And turning into a deal with Variety Magazine. They went to the right source. I mean, Variety is about as good as you get in Hollywood in reporting about Hollywood. So they was trying to get it out there to, you know, to push their agenda of Warrior, everybody not knowing that Warrior was going to win the belt.
But why? So why though did they want everyone to think Warrior was going to win when Warrior was going to win?
No, they didn't want people to think Warrior was going to win.
Then why did they plant the story if the story?
Oh, wait a minute. I'm wrong. I said it wrong. No, they want. It's weird.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, considering he's going to win anyway. Yeah. Their logic sometimes is is backward.
I guess. I mean, they would never do anything like manipulating the media and plant stories.
No, never.
Especially, they would never plant stories to people who really don't like me.
Well, speaking of WWF and media, they held their official press conference for WrestleMania 6 on the 5th of February in Toronto at Skydome. And it was officially announced that Hulk Hogan will defend his title against the Warrior. Both men have been acting like heels lately, and Warrior's supposed to act like a major heel to the reporters at the press conference.
Shocking.
But most believe he was just being himself.
Shocking.
Which wasn't part of the plan. Now, on the 7th, WWF was claiming to have hit the $1 million Canadian mark in ticket sales for the show, meaning 17,000 tickets. But Ticketron in Canada claimed that the first day sales were closer to 6,000, and most of the tickets sold for the $50 seats, which would be a record-breaking first day in North America. Titan did take 9,000 seats off the board before pre-sale for VIPs, though. There is a lot of local publicity about the show, but it's mainly negative because the media is complaining about the high ticket prices, with the first 10 rows of ringside being $150, rest of the building price from $100 to $25. Now, you know, we talk about this like this now, and, you know, how mania is these days where, God, they sell
ringside is 2,000 or more.
Yeah,
now,
and they sell tens of thousands of seats.
And that's face value.
As soon as tickets go on sale. Ticketron said they only sold 6,000 tickets in the Tokyo Dome on the first day. So that shows you how mania has changed over the years. And even back then, it was the big show, but it wasn't like it is now.
Because you're still selling based on the main event. Now it's WrestleMania. Now you're going to – the point is you're going to WrestleMania. It's not that you're waiting to see what the main event is or whatever.
Yeah. Warrior. He would never act like an asshole.
Never.
He's never done his life.
Hell of a nice guy.
And Dave is right. If you watch the television – that's leading up to this stuff. Yeah, Hogan and Warrior both act like pricks. Yeah, I mean, it is really weird. You know, one's supposed to be, I mean, they're both supposed to be baby faces, but they're both acting like heels.
Grab the controls, Hogan.
Hogan. Oh, man. Those Warrior promos, something else. All right. Matt Walsh reported that Titan is planning a major international expansion in the next year, which includes taping television in foreign countries. Hmm. Matt Walsh has learned that Titan is scheduling stops in London, Paris, Germany, Australia, and South America. The plans are regular tapings of the WWF syndicated shows on an international basis. A source told Matt Walsh that it's, quote, the next natural progression in our business, and it should solidify the public's mind that the WWF title is the only world title, unquote. This plan is coming hot on the heels of WWF agreeing to do business with All Japan and New Japan for the Tokyo Dome show in April.
They didn't do this.
Nope.
But I read this and I feel like they kind of should have.
Yes. Because they're very successful promoting internationally.
Yeah, I mean, if they could have done tapings, whether it was
Paris.
Paris
had that cool venue.
With the little tunnel thing and the girls and the legs and
yeah, London had those the steps. Remember that when they were
Would have looked really cool on TV, and it would have and they also would have had much hotter crowds for than usual for TV.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great idea that never came to pass. It makes no sense why they didn't, unless they didn't want to pay the high travel costs or whatever.
Yeah, well, because also it's TV, so you're flying a lot of guys in.
Yeah, you're flying your production crew and all this other stuff, yeah. Unless in the jobbers, maybe they could use local guys. I don't know.
Well, they had to use local guys for in some spots, remember? Like, you know, they had the dark match with Finley and Dave Taylor and whoever.
Okay, imagine Fit Finley working like WF syndicated television. Like, you get a random, like, Fit Finley versus Greg Valentine match, or a random, you know, Fit Finley versus Mr. Perfect. I mean, oh, God.
From Belfast, Dave Finn.
or like a young Steve Regal, you know, working those guys or something like that. Steve Regal versus Bret Hart.
Let's be real, though. This is your WWF squashes. This is not WCW syndication.
Yeah, it would have been like 4 minutes. Matt Watch also reported that there is talk that Roddy Piper may negotiate himself out of the WWF and go back to Portland to help Don Owen again. Supposedly, Piper is upset, working double shots on weekends, as well as being removed from primetime wrestling, which we talked about that on a previous episode, Between the Sheets. And Piper had been in Portland the year earlier, up in Don Owen, before he went back to the WWF. And Portland that year had some of the best television they had in a long time. When Piper was helping out the booking, it was very exciting. But
he was the ghost booker.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, Piper stuck around, and he benefited from Jesse Ventura leaving a few months later.
Funny how that works.
What were your thoughts? I mean, we talk about Piper at this time period. You know, he was just he had the bad news deal going on. You know, that was a Mania match, and he. It seemed like they should have done more with Piper. He should have been pushed higher than what he was. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm trying to figure out, like, what really did he do after the Rude program was over?
Like, he dicked around and then started the Bad News Feud.
Yeah, and then there's the Bad News Feud. I mean, he does, you know, he's in the Intercontinental title tournament. He's one of the guys that gets eliminated in the first round in the, you know, with the draws. But I'm trying to think of, like, what is he doing like later in the year? And
well, he's basically just announcing.
Yeah, he's basically just announcing anyway once Jesse leaves. So, I mean, it worked out well for him in the end.
Yeah, he didn't do a role until the Virgil angle.
Right. And so, then when did he become a full time wrestler again? Was it just right before he got the Intercontinental title?
It was after when Flair came in.
Yeah. Okay. So, that's right.
So, yeah. Yeah, Piper's career was just interesting in this time period. Just all the things that happened. This is trajectory was crazy.
But he still had a lot to offer, though. I mean, he's still very good in the ring.
Yes, very good.
And that would change in a couple of years, though, after the hip surgery.
Yeah. So, yep. And speaking of guys that were great performers before, they had issues, health issues. WF has talked to Terry Gordy about coming in after the proposed match against Hulk Hogan at the Tokyo Dome in April. It is rumored that Gordy wants to save the wear and tear on his knees and that a 2-year deal has been talked about. Well, now, let's.
Well, yeah. I wonder why that didn't happen.
Yeah, but think about this, though, okay? What if Gordy goes there? How different is Terry Gordy's career? Does Terry Gordy have the stroke?
Or
he have his issues.
Well, I think he has his issues, but he doesn't have the need to take as many pills as possible on a plane to knock himself out for a flight to Japan.
Exactly.
It's not that he had problems necessarily that directly led to it. Was that it was like his known thing. Terry's going to take a ton of pills. He's going to basically sleep the entire flight to Japan. Someone will wake him up at the airport. It'll take a day to sober up, and then he'll be fine. And then he overdosed on the plane one time. Well, no, he overdosed twice, right?
Yeah.
And the second time was the bad one, so to speak, relatively speaking, where he was clinically dead and all that.
Well, the first time, you know, remember they had the pool hall or whatever it was they were at, the bar that we talked about on the show. they had that issue at that. That's when he had the the Triple Crown time period. I think when he lost the title, so they had to take the title off of him because he had just won it. And they took it off of him 2 days later because of his health, because of what happened.
And I mean, he's a guy who always did have problems, though. It's not a secret, but it was the, it was that whole process that was what caused the problems and that led to the brain damage. It was not just, oh, one day he overdosed. It said he had this system for his flights.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sad. But yeah. Gordon WWF, though, I mean.
Well, yeah, the Hogan thing. Should we explain the Hogan thing?
Yeah, go ahead and tell everyone about the Hogan thing.
So the match ended up being Stan Hansen at the Tokyo Dome. It was going to be Gordy and Hogan, and basically Hogan was going to win. Gordy was okay with that because even though he was, he wasn't champion yet, right?
Who?
Gordy.
No.
But he was the top foreigner.
Hansen, I think, would still be the top foreigner.
Hansen was a bit, but Gordy was on his way.
Yes, he was getting the rise. Yeah.
And he was fine with doing the job until Hogan lost the title at WrestleMania because Vince, for some reason, did not tell Baba that he was doing the title switch.
Yeah.
So Baba's all upset also because now his title match is the Ultimate Warrior against Ted DiBiase. And then Gordy's like, I'm not – Gordy's already has issues with this. And then Stan Hansen – riles him up about it, how he shouldn't do the job to their guy there, especially if it's not title match or whatever. And then Gordy pulls out, and who saves the day but Stan Hansen.
What a coincidence.
And then Stan gets over as the guy who saved the show, and that was a big part of building Stan as like a totally made, you know, he's already a huge star, but this is what made him a made legend in Japan. And All from what manipulating Terry Gordy. That's Hogan level. That is Hogan. I mean, it really is.
Yes. What political maneuvering. Wow. That's phenomenal. But we thought about, I kind of hinted this earlier when talking about Buddy Landell, but another buddy was coming to WWF as Buddy Rose is headed here, presumably as a comedy jobber in late March. And Pez Bodley is also heading in to be a jobber as well. Of course, Buddy Rose Bix is remembered for the blowaway diet video in this time period.
Yeah, and I wonder how much those like full-time touring job guys made.
Oh, so, God.
Buddy Rose, Barry Horowitz, Pez Bodley, Al Perez, Black Bart, etc.
They probably did okay.
They probably made at least $75,000 a year, I would think.
Yeah, enough to keep them out of the territories, you know, trying to wear territory stuff.
Right.
But yeah, Pez Watley was just an odd choice as well. And just odd seeing guys like that there. Tim Horner, you know, guys like that. Shane Douglas later on in the year. Yeah, WF would have their little eyeballs in this era.
Yeah, and Shane Douglas was sort of almost pushed. He was at a level above those guys.
Yes. Yes.
He had entrance music.
Yes. Yes, he did.
And this was during a period where still not everyone had entrance music.
Yeah, I know. All right. Another guy, Dave also, and we talked about this as well in the previous shows, Dave also gets that Bob Orton Jr.'s deal is either on hold or just canceled altogether since he has taken more independent dates.
It's starting to seem like every issue from like, that we're looking at from like 88 to 91 or 92, there's a Bob Orton maybe coming in story.
Yeah. Which is weird because it's Bob Orton Jr.
Yeah.
And I like Bob Orton Jr., but
look at how his run in WCW was in 89.
Yeah. Yeah. It was not that good. Not that good.
Did not set the world on fire.
No. And in our final story, which is a nice compliment to last week, as we talked about this last week, Vince McMahon is planning on getting into the bodybuilding world, as he is wanting to start a magazine called, quote, Bodybuilding Lifestyles, unquote.
Of the rich and vainous.
Vince wants
to, Vince wants to be ripped and vainous.
Ripped and vainous, yeah. I'm getting choked up thinking about it. Vince wants to compete against Joe Weider in the magazine world, and the thoughts are it wouldn't be long that he would try to compete with him in the competition world.
Dun, dun, dun.
So here we go, folks. The beginning. A full year before, you know, it officially became to be.
Right, well, the press conferences, you know, 51 weeks later, although they had, you know, the announcement was in September at the Olympia, though. So, but yes.
Yeah.
And that the one caveat is, as far as whether or not this seems like a ridiculous idea, it was only a few years earlier that they stopped airing Mr. Olympia on Wide World of Sports and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's not like now where bodybuilding is, like, you know, not a thing as far as the general public is concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's nothing pretty much these days.
Right. And I guess, part of that is probably just how ridiculous the bodybuilders look now, that they don't really look human anymore.
Yeah, it is pretty ridiculous.
And besides that, it's also bodybuilding.
Yeah. There's nothing going on but just a bunch of flexing.
Right. But the point being, though, like, people knew who Arnold was before he became an actor.
Oh, totally. Yeah. He was, well, though, Lou Ferrigno.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's earlier than we're talking about, but it's not like it was seen as this thing that only gay muscle fetishists and gym and steroid heads are into.
Dale Veezy fans.
I didn't say muscle bears. You know, I was explaining to someone recently that there the what used to be the closest strip club to me, and I regret that I never got to experience it. It just heard stories. It was a place called Bear Necessity. Or Bear Necessities, one or the other, but they spelled it BEAR.
Oh,
but it was women. Well, it was not a gay bear strip.
I was about to say, why'd you want to go there so much?
Like, they just misspelled it for decades.
Well, you're more of a twink, Bix, anyway, than the bear.
Jesus. I was just this little hole in the wall near a church and a supermarket and a marine supply store.
What a group of buildings.
And a couple of motels.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. You had to have that. Every good strip club has a motel near it.
With the signs about how they have color TV and cable.
Yes, we do have cable.
40 different channels.
Yes. Hilarious.
So yeah, the Bodybuilding Lifestyles magazine. You know, a couple years ago, like, I bought at I think it was WrestleCon, like, from someone who had a bunch of dollar wrestling magazines. I did get a couple issues of WBF magazine just to check it out.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's kind of what you'd expect, except, so you know how the layout of WWF magazine was at the time with, like, it wasn't quite as kiddie as it would be in a few years later when they went, like, fully into that with Scoop Sullivan and all that, but
yeah,
it was, but the way the layout was with the colors and the whatever. So it's that, but as a bodybuilding magazine.
Yeah.
It's peculiar. That actually reminds me. There's a story that Fred Hatfield, who was the director of research and development for WBF, that he told me that I decided not to use in the article for Fighting Spirit, but I might as well repeat here. I'm forgetting her name all of a sudden. The woman they hired as the editor for the magazine, she had previously been in charge of Playgirl.
Oh, yeah.
And the first issue, they had shot a photo spread where she was gung-ho about trying to market the magazine to the gay community. And it was, like, not, like, overt, but, like, very, like, I'm trying to remember how he described it, because it was very, like guys, like posing together on the beach type of thing.
Yeah.
And he saw it, and he went to Vince and got it shut down. Now, the thing being, though, I mean, the bodybuilding magazines, especially in their infancy, were marketed to gay men who, especially, like, you know, like in the you know, 50s and 60s or whatever, you know, they had to be covert, so they'd buy these fitness magazines and stuff. So
yeah,
that I guess she, with working at Playgirl, wanted to go along with that, but it was, I'm not describing it well enough. I know that, but I thought it was an interesting story, and shows that Vince just had a very pure love for bodybuilding, I guess.
Yeah, which Triple H, you know, has that same pure love of bodybuilding too.
But it's, yeah, and he's into the striation and the. So long, everybody.
The striation. Oh, look at his pecs.
Bodybuilding as it was meant to be. Drug, yeah. 100% drug free.
Oh, man. Anyway, plug time, Bix.
But what, that was a lot of drawn out trying to explain how to describe these naked men on this beach with their bulging muscles and.
Well, like I said, plug time.
Yeah, that, I don't know if those are the words I'd use either. Oh boy. What, you don't want to plug anything for?
No, I'll let you go. I got my plugs.
Okay. Yeah, I went again, phrasing.
Yeah.
Oh God. No one leave us alone. This is Tim's fault. For leaving us to our leisure. this week I would think the big thing is 605 Super Podcast. Jim Cornette was back on. And we did not talk about Lucha Underground.
That's good.
Well, I mean, you listened to it, but we just talked about all sorts of things. I thought this one was better than the first show.
Yeah, I thought it was really good.
And this was, you know, lots of, you know, fun stuff, just talking about all sorts of old wrestling, Eddie Gilbert, Randy Savage shoving steak down his pants. That's true.
Yeah.
We found out it's a true story.
Yeah.
I mean, some interesting insight into how Savage was living during the ICW era, too, and because they weren't doing well.
They were not.
And tons of stuff. Probably what Jim called the greatest response to an "it's fake" type question that he's ever heard, and I would have to agree with him.
Yeah.
Just tons of stuff. Hey, what was your favorite part?
I think Jim doing the play-by-play of the match was. I mean, doing the commentary on the match was good.
Oh, Rock and Roll Roy Toy.
Yeah.
Yes, I did also sync that up, and that's also on YouTube. If you want to see Jim Cornette doing commentary on a match featuring Rock and Roll Roy Toy, he also gives his thoughts on God Bold.
Yeah.
That's a put in there that it turns out that he had also been sent a video of God Bold, who we talked about because Bo James sent us some videos he got from this man known only as God Bold. Although the video Jim got sounds even better because, like, he had like a Godbold's guitar was all tricked out with like fiber optic lighting and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can check that out at 605pod.com. And yeah, I mean, sure, he will be on again soon. And yeah, otherwise, just got my usual stuff to plug. Follow me on Twitter at David Bix. Of course, check out my stuff in Fighting Spirit magazine at f4wonline.com and Figure 4 Weekly. And of course, at SE Scoops and MMA News. Excuse me, I keep almost burping. At least I didn't actually burp like you did. Yeah.
I can't help myself sometimes when I talk. I'm trying to talk and it happens.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Jesus Christ, did you hear that?
We're getting choked up on this show, I'm telling you.
It's an emotional experience.
Yeah. All right, you done with your plug so I can get all mine in?
You're doing that deliberately now, aren't you?
I got a lot of plugs this time.
Where did you get those plugs?
I got them from Amazon.com, which you can go using tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon to get all your needs. And we get a little piece of the pie as well. So that's the main thing we need to plug on the show.
Yes.
Other than that, Exile on Bad Street, the final episode of Smoky Mountain Wrestling has been sent to the editors and it's on them to when it comes in. So, well, to people heading the show. So we'll see how that plays out when it shows up. But it was really good, about a four-hour show. So par for the course. And Dylan Hales and Tim Knoll, me and myself, talk about the 1995 run of Smoky Mountain Wrestling and really good stuff. So be on the lookout for that. Between the Sheets, every Monday, of course, as you know. If you're a new listener, yep, expect it every Monday. And I can say what we're going to do next week, as we will go to 1993 next week. A lot of things going on that week. Firings, hirings, and yeah, it should be a week of long reads.
It's a pivotal week in newsletter history, to be completely honest. Because, yeah. Something very ethically questionable happens.
Yes. Yes, very, very. And it could be some long reads going on that week. But yeah, 1993, check that out. I had a guest spot this week on the Talking Sheet Midweek Show on SheetSandwich.com, where I was joined by Dylan Hales, of course, Les Moore, and Celia Bloom, discussing a lot of wide topics involving the current wrestling scene, WWE political hits, the Sunny Porn, Lucha Underground, all kinds of stuff. I thought it was a great show, and it's always good that I can talk current stuff, because most shows I do is about stuff in the past. So, yeah, check that out. SheetSandwich.com. What else do I have to plug?
Well, it's coming out, not coming out for a few weeks, but you've got something else coming out.
Yeah, I want to wait, though.
Okay.
Wait till that's officially officially on the way out. I got a special project that's coming out in written form. So be on the lookout for that coming up as well. And Exxon Bad Street, I'm going to be getting those shows lined up, the feature shows, Hudson Prazak, Bo James, I talked to him, you know, about the Continental show. So we got some stuff in the works from that. But other than that, I'd like to thank Tim for being on earlier. In fact, let me go ahead and explain what Tim had to do. Tim forgot he had to announce a basketball game tonight. Tim does announcing for high school basketball games in the area and does other announcing. Of course, he announces with Eric Ritz from Segunda Caída on an indie wrestling group there, which I can't remember the name of. But, yeah, Tim's a professional announcer, and he totally forgot about that gig. He thought we'd be done by that time. Little does he know how we work, huh, Bix? There was no way we could get done that early. But, yeah, I'd like to thank him for being on the show. Bix, of course, the rock of this show, as usual. Thank you for being here every week. And for Chris, saying so long from the peach state of Georgia.
I was in Jeff's crib one night about 8. And we were watching a couple of Mike Tyson fight tapes. Jeff was like,
man, you see how hard Mike's punching?
Come on, Jeff, the other guy was just lunging. Left, right, another KO. Ooh. If that was me, I'd have been okay, though. The very next day, I gave Russell a ring. With JL and Lior, we all called Don King. I said, yeah, Don, I got a problem.
Tell him, Prince.
Yeah, what's up? What you saying? You trying to solve them? Forget the small talk. Let's get to the nitty-gritty. Me and Mike, 2 months. Trump, Atlantic City.
Yo, you got this. You want to bust dude up.
Yeah, you can be my trainer.
Word up?
I'm rough like a freight train, smooth like ice. And yo, Jeff, straight up, I think I can beat Mike Tyson.
Man, you can beat him, man.
Yo, man, word.
You can beat him, man.
You know, I put on a couple pounds, man. We can do this, man.
You can do it.
Here he comes, Jerry Stridham. Wow! Take a look at that! Top hat and cane. Talk about stepping out for a night on the town. Oh, my goodness. Look at that mass. Holy cow. Ooh, look at the striation. Jerry Stridham is pumped up. Side chest, give it to him. Strider really knows how to strut his style. guys are back. What a posing routine thus far.
You like him down?
I think there's no question about that. Jerry Strider, what a raw. Oh, no, look at that. Put together as only Jerry Strider can be. Strider just may have the most dense muscular package we've seen. Look at this. Thinking about it, we could be thinking about seeing the next WBF champion.